I think we're going to get started. We need a few more members to have a quorum, but why don't we proceed? Representative Peterson, are you guys ready, or do you need this? Okay. We don't have a quorum quite yet, but I think we'll just start on presentation of your bill. And whichever one you want to think we should start. How about 3410?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for getting us in the schedule. Weather's a little deteriorating in western Minnesota, and the person down here has been driving most of the day. This is basically stop-loss fund, which I believe the state had in 2001. It repealed in 2007, proposes to reenact section 2569.956, 256.9561, maybe similar to the state subsidy stop-loss fund to New York's Healthy New York program. With me today is basically general fund reinsurance. With me today is Professor Greg Gorson from the University of Minnesota at Morris, but today representing the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance.
And why don't we just go through, if you want to go through both bills,
okay,
we can do that and then go from there.
Let's do this.
Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Thiessen and members of the House Health and Human Services Committee. My name is Greg Thorson. I'm the research coordinator for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. And that West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance is a group of small business owners, healthcare providers, and insurance agents that reside in the 12-county area of West Central Minnesota. I provided written testimony to you, and you can see the location then in Figure 1 of the location of our purchasing alliance. Our mission is to offer more affordable, high-quality health insurance options for small employers and residents in our region, and we have held numerous public forums in the region, have administered hundreds of surveys to our area businesses. We are registered as a purchasing alliance with the Minnesota Department of Health, as provided for by the Minnesota Community Purchasing Act that was passed by the legislature in 1997. And I have served as the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance's primary research coordinator since the group formation in 2003. My academic credentials include a BA in political science from Augsburg College in 1988 and a master's and PhD in political science from the University of California, Riverside in 1995. And since 1995, I'm employed as a political science professor at the University of Minnesota Morris campus. However, the views that I'm expressing today are solely mine and do not necessarily represent the views of the University of Minnesota or the Board of Regents. As you know, rural Minnesota is in a healthcare crisis, and the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance then recently administered a survey to our 12-county area businesses in the summer of 2003, and the results are alarming. Some of this can be found in the testimony that I've written to you, given to you, that an alarming 55% of employers in our region indicated that they're either very or somewhat likely to drop health care coverage for their employees if premiums continue to rise. In fact, more than 1 in 10 employers has already discontinued offering health insurance to their employers in the past 5 years alone. Further complicating the problem is this national trend that really affects rural Minnesota differently than urban Minnesota. Figure 1, as you can see on page 3 of your testimony, shows that for small businesses in Minnesota, or for small businesses in the United States, those that have less than 10 employees, only 52% can offer health care insurance to their employers. Compare that to large firms of 200 or more workers, where 99% can offer that. So the problem for rural Minnesota is that we have a large number of very small businesses. Over 75% of the businesses in our region have less than 10 employees. So the bill developed by our Purchasing Alliance and authored by Representative Peterson addresses the rural health care insurance crisis by providing funding for stop-loss coverage for small employers with less than 49 employees who have not offered their employees health coverage during the past 12 months. So the state-subsidized stop-loss fund will cover individual health care expenses incurred by an individual in a calendar year that total between $30,000 and $100,000. Our fully funded partner, who is yet to be selected but will be selected through a fair and open RFP process, would then have a significant incentive to work with us to provide insurance to the small employers in our region. In fact, the liability of that fully insured partner would extend from the deductible up to $30,000, but then only above $100,000 per individual. And our experience has been that in the absence of any incentives, fully insured partners are reluctant to work with our region's small businesses. Many fully insured partners are less comfortable with rural employers, small businesses, and particularly to those small businesses that have not recently offered health care insurance to their employers. Many of them fear that there will be substantial health care expenditures during the first terms of offering coverage. And so a state-subsidized stop-loss fund, like is proposed here, would minimize the exposure for these fully insured partners and encourage the formation of partnerships between them and the various purchasing alliances in the state, with the ultimate goal being that to ensure more rural Minnesotans. Now, the state-subsidized stop-loss funds that is proposed here has been central to many state health care reforms, and most notably, perhaps, in New York's Healthy New York program. But in 2001, this legislative body also passed and became into law a nearly identical stop-loss fund, but it was repealed in 2007 due to the fact that it had not been used by the purchasing alliances in operation at that time. So the proposal before you today then would reenact that stop-loss fund and extend the eligible time frame to 2013. The approximate cost for the bill to cover up to 3,000 people through 2013 with this stop-loss product is estimated to cost about $6 million. But if the program is successful, it could result in significant cost savings, as many of those who would enroll are now likely enrolled in Minnesota Care. Increasing or decreasing the appropriation for the stop-loss would increase or decrease the number of people we would be able to insure.
Thank you. Are there questions? Well, first of all, we're going to call the meeting officially to order. Just so people know, we are likely to get through... if you're here for 2855... Well, maybe not. But if you're here for 3400, 3955, or 3371, that'll probably be this evening. So you can feel free to leave this afternoon. I will move House File. I think we'll actually start with 3243, Representative Peterson, which is the other bill, as an initial motion. Do you want to discuss 3243 as well, what that does? And then we can have questions on both bills, and then we'll go, because they kind of run together a little bit.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Keeson, and members of the Health Human Services Committee. Again, I have a handout of my copy of my testimony. It looks like this. And so this is for HF 3243. This would make changes to Minnesota Care eligibility in a way that would be beneficial to all Minnesotans, but particularly rural Minnesotans. I'm beginning my discussion on page 3 of that handout. So the bill developed by a purchasing alliance here that we're looking at and authored by Representative Peterson addresses a major problem with Minnesota Care. While Minnesota Care offers a generally comprehensive benefit set to over 120,000 subscribers, it nevertheless limits inpatient hospitalization for most subscribers to just $10,000. And Table 1 shows to whom that $10,000 limit applies. Now, not only does Minnesota Care fail to provide adequate coverage for inpatient hospitalization, it also prohibits enrollees from having any other health care coverage. As a result, then, Minnesota Care enrollees are exposed to significant financial risk. Tables 2 and 3 in your packet show, then, some bad news, that the average inpatient hospitalization costs of major diagnostic categories and specific diagnoses in Minnesota for the year 2006. I just wanted to demonstrate for you how very frequent it is that, and how commonplace it is for inpatient hospitalization costs to exceed the $10,000 limit covered by Minnesota Care. So, for example, in Table 2, you can see by major classification, this is data taken from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. For example, the fourth category down, burns. A typical burn diagnosis would cost on average $41,455 in hospitalization, far above the $10,000 inpatient hospitalization limit allowed by Minnesota Care. If you look over at Table 3 on page 5, you can see some specific diagnoses, again from that same database. A heart transplant now will cost you $335,000 in inpatient hospitalization. Bone marrow transplant, $304,000. But even when you look at more frequent things like a respiratory system diagnosis, over 1,600 of those in Minnesota, with the cost of inpatient hospitalization costs that exceed $69,000. It's not uncommon at all to have very high costs. So after examining the staggering costs, it's perhaps not surprising that medical bankruptcies are now the leading cause of personal bankruptcies. And it's important to note, then, that the state is making Minnesota care available to more Minnesotans, including adults without children. Since January 1, 2008, adults without children are now eligible for Minnesota care, with incomes up to 200% of the poverty guideline. On July 1, 2009, that percent increases to 215% of the federal poverty guideline. The question I want to ask you, then, as a committee, is what happens if a Minnesota care enrollee has a major medical problem, such as those listed in Tables 2 and 3. For adults with children under the age of 20, there is some help. Those people can use what's called a spend-down procedure, in which they can use their eligible medical expenses to reduce the calculation of their eligible income until they become eligible for the unlimited hospitalization coverage available for medical assistance. That still, nevertheless, can be very expensive. Those spend-downs can be very expensive. They'll be required to reduce their pay difference from, in some cases, from their 275% of the poverty line down to 100% of the poverty line for up to a six-month period in order to qualify for that inpatient hospitalization limit coverage. However, it's even worse for adults that don't have children under the age of 20. There is no spend-down option available for them. They are going to be required, they'll be personally liable for all the inpatient hospitalization charges that exceed $10,000. And when your committee was kind enough to come out to Benson in December, we had testimony from members there that talked about how they thought that they had inpatient hospitalization coverage to cover that and were surprised to find out that it was capped at $10,000. Attempts made last year to increase the hospitalization cap to $15,000 failed. And this year's budget deficit of approximately $935 million, as we all know, severely limits the ability of the legislature to remove the cap. So what should we do? And our solution is simple. We propose that the state should modify the eligibility for Minnesota care to allow employees to carry a private hospitalization policy that would be used solely for the purpose of covering hospitalization charges that exceed Minnesota Care's $1,000 cap. We believe that the fact that the state has increased access to Minnesota Care is admirable, but it exacerbates the problem even larger due to the fact that many of these newly eligible enrollees will not be eligible then for inpatient hospitalization coverage in excess of $10,000. So in conclusion, we ask that the legislature consider allowing Minnesota Care enrollees to make a small change in their eligibility to fill the gap in hospitalization coverages by allowing these recipients, the enrollees of Minnesota Care, to purchase a private supplemental inpatient hospitalization policy that covers them in the event that those annual hospitalization costs exceed $10,000.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to move House File 3243 that it be recommended to pass and to the General Register. Are there questions on 3243? Okay, seeing no questions, all those in favor of the motion? Oh, I'm sorry, Danette wanted to testify. Ms. Coleman wants to testify. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I will be brief and actually I will comment on both bills here. And Jeanette Coleman with Medica, and I just want to state that I'm not here necessarily to oppose these bills. I just want to provide some context around these two bills that I think are important to this committee. The first law in House File 3243, which would, I think, very smartly ensure that individuals don't lose eligibility for Minnesota care if they have other coverage that covers the portion of the hospital coverage that Minnesota care does not. I do want to say these products don't exist. Nobody offers hospital-only coverage, and certainly hospital-only coverage that would have to be priced at after $10,000. Talking with our folks, asking their comment was, we would not even know how to price this sort of a product. I think that the other question is that individuals who are in Minnesota care, whether or not they could actually be able to afford these products, even if they were available in the market. And I guess ideally, and I know that we have a bit of a budget crunch going on here, but ideally the way that this should be addressed is to get rid of the $10,000 cap, or at least increase the $10,000 cap. But I think as this legislation is drafted, I don't think it is harmful. I just think that you might be creating some false hope for individuals when these products do not exist in the market.
Yeah, and I would say that you've been very creative in developing new kinds of products in recent years, and I have trust that you'd be able to figure this, or maybe not the health plans in Minnesota, maybe some of the smaller insurance companies could figure this one out as well. President Gallo.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to the concerns just expressed, I think another angle to come at this from is this is a weakness in the Minnesota Care Program itself. It is meant to be kind of a lower benefit package for people in need, and if in fact they need supplement to meet their needs, maybe that suggests that we need to create some lower cost options other than Minnesota Care. And I know that we're all about trying to find those, but in addition to identifying a supplement, it seems like we're trying to tack something onto something when in fact we could create a private sector package that might, there may be packages out there that provide more comprehensive benefits, which is I think what we're trying to do here. And maybe get a few more people off Minnesota Care and save the state some money.
And President Gott, well, you know we're trying to do that, but obviously the health plans haven't figured that one out yet, how the price goes. So,
Mr. Chair, I do have some comments on House Bill 3243.
Why don't we finish go with 3243, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I think it's kind of a creative solution, and I'm just trying to I always try and find the unanticipated consequences. And one thing that I didn't see added in here was, since we're in our healthcare reform initiative, taking away many of the barriers to Minnesota Care, not being without insurance for 4 months, et cetera, I'm just wondering if we might be at risk of small employers dropping comprehensive coverage in order to get the state to subsidize the first outpatient benefit through Minnesota Care, and then they can buy the cheaper $10,000-plus kind of product above it. And so I'm just trying to figure out how the pieces might work together, because I don't think that's the intent of the author at all. It's to expand access to comprehensive coverage. The question is whether or not it could be used in that way to actually shift more burdens onto Minnesota Care at a time when the governor's proposing to reduce the imbalances within that fund to begin with.
Any further discussion? Mr. Weber.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I had an emergency call out where I went to. And I don't want to repeat what people have said. Can you just tell me the track of this bill? Will this go to finance?
This one's going to the floor.
To the floor. This bill here.
3243.
Wouldn't there be a note on the healthcare access fund on this?
No. It just allows someone to buy a supplemental product above. You'd have to qualify under all the current requirements to qualify for Minnesota Care.
Okay.
And these products don't exist, apparently, so, yeah.
Well, maybe I don't understand that.
All this bill would do is say that if you otherwise qualify for Minnesota Care, and it would allow you to buy in the private market a supplemental policy above $10,000 just to cover inpatient costs. So you'd have to qualify for Minnesota Care under current rules, and then you'd be able to buy this policy, and that policy wouldn't count as other insurance, you know, that would otherwise disqualify you from Minnesota Care.
That's all just offer a comment. I appreciate that. I was getting the two bills mixed up. So it seems to me if the people, and I don't mind this, but it just seems that you look stepping back, and maybe you already said this, but you start buying these add-on policies, which aren't going to be cheap, I wouldn't think. Are they like, there's some cost. And you add on the per member per month cost, and then of the state chair, and then you're getting to be to buy a real policy. Probably through the exchange, maybe, Mr. Chair, if we had the grid exchange. I'll stop. But I think as we step, is this going to just go on its own and become a law by itself, or is this going to be part of your health package? Or
this is going to run on its own, yeah.
Just a suggestion, and Representative Peterson as well, that there's a lot of, if you get too many piecemeal pieces floating around, you got kind of a oddling little group of stuff. So maybe it might get rolled into the big deal.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, thanks so much for bringing this forward and thinking about this issue, which I think is really, really important. And I just wanted to see if you had sort of any idea what a supplemental policy like this might cost? Because I think that, you know, that might impact, obviously, if it would be, you know, something that would be in the range that people on Minnesota Care could reasonably be able to buy, then it might be very useful. But if it would turn out to be something that was so high, it might not be worth doing.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I guess my advocate for the bill, my answer would be really, really cheap, but I can't, I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we've actually had some insurance agents in our area do some looks at what are bare bones insurance policies that provide inpatient hospitalization. Even though that plan with hospitalization alone doesn't exist, there are fairly similar plans that exist right now. And the estimate based on some various insurance agents from different companies that have estimated that that could be as low as $50 or less per month, just because that only provides inpatient hospitalization costs greater than $10,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For $50 or less per month, I was thinking for a single person or
covered body.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on that point. I think there was just testimony previously, though, that said there's not a product like this out on the market right now. So we're making some wild assumptions, I would say, if the plans themselves have testified that there's not a product out there right now that meets this. I mean, what is the answer? We're hearing two different answers.
Correct. I agree. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, although there is no plan that exists per se that only covers inpatient hospitalization above $10,000. There are plans that have that component part to it that either have $10,000 deductible, that have more a comprehensive benefit set than simply hospitalization. And so we've worked with actuaries. We've brought lots of people to the table from the Healthcare Purchasing Alliance in a variety of forums to do that. And yeah, I mean, we don't have an exact number about what that will be, but it will be very affordable compared to other types of products out there. I think the point that we want to make right now is that right now there's that gaping hole of there is no inpatient hospitalization coverage above $10,000 at all for many people under Minnesota Care right now. And many of them are under the perception that they do have this coverage, and they're at significant financial risk. Our belief is that if this would pass, that there would be a significant incentive to craft this rather narrowly tailored product that would simply provide inpatient hospitalization expenses above $10,000 for the market to do. It would just be a modification of essentially a bare-bones plan now that would ride on the back of Minnesota Care with this much more comprehensive benefit set.
Just a quick follow-up. So then what I'm hearing is, and not to oversimplify this, but if we pass it, it will come. Essentially what you're saying is pass this, the market will respond to the government's movement on the bill.
Maybe, yes. but if we don't do it, it won't. Yeah. Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I see with this kind of piece of rural health care and the farmers, and there are a lot of farmers out there that have to have insurance if they have a loan at the bank. And I can give you a couple examples of, and they do the $10,000 is what they do. And I had a case not too long ago where they had a baby. Of course, they didn't have any money in the health savings account because there wasn't any money there. So that's at least $10,000 or more to have a baby. Well, then it went into the next calendar, and the baby got sick. And they couldn't go to the clinic because they didn't pay their bills yet. And so that's the kind of stuff that I'm hearing. There was another case where the baby was blue in the hands and the legs, and they literally were told, when the baby's face gets blue, come in. And so this is what's happening. They're doing the 10,000 premium, but they're not getting anything. When they have a claim, there's no money there to pay. And so I think this is the piece that I tried to pass last year would have helped a lot, but it's still in a waiver system. But that's quite frankly what's happening. And it's not in even in Minnesota. It's in, I think, the There's about 7 states that we're looking at. You've heard about those kinds of things. And they're almost always $10,000, and then they don't have really any coverage anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, again, this to me suggests either you modify the Minnesota Care package. I mean, we've talked about this limitation before with regard to small employers. I think Representative Murphy would remember those discussions. If this is a limitation of Minnesota Care, then modify Minnesota Care, or we look to the market to create a package other than that. But we're actually, I mean, imagine the complexity. Now you've got 2 health plans to accomplish what one should. And just to give you an example of how the marketplace is already responding to some of these needs, there are agents out there right now who are selling to people a catastrophic package, which is low cost. I think we just heard that testified to. They're selling a catastrophic package and then taking the savings for people, how much they would have spent on a comprehensive package, putting that in an HSA from which they pay their medical expenses, which becomes kind of a self-directed account, and they're saving a lot of money. It's becoming much more affordable for them. So there are some ways in which the market's already responding to these kinds of things. But to me, this either suggests encourage the private market to come up with the package or change Minnesota Care. But to create the administrative complexity of having 2 coverages instead of 1 for low-income people, I think, is kind of a band-aid approach.
Fair enough, but when you take $250 million from the health care access fund, you're not really going to be expanding Minnesota Care. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to get my thoughts more clear. I think I can offer some advice to the author. And I think we should pass this out today just because we're trying to get every good idea to move along. But I think in the end of the game, I think that something like this, if it's going to be moving, I don't know if it's moving in the Senate or not, but it seems like you should fill this into your package. But I think what you might do is, instead of having this way, that you would allow people to buy up under the HMO, under the TMAP programs that they already get from Minnesota Care, and you would allow them to buy a ticket purchase and an enhanced option in the plans, because the plans actually could even sell this bolt-on package, but they could probably sell an enhanced benefit set where people would pay cash for the upcharge. And I bet it'd be very economical because there'd only be 1 administrator. And so maybe it's a move out for today, but I think Representative Peterson and I can talk to him a little bit, and maybe as part of your package we can suggest that that's happened. And there'd be no state cost, and it would allow people to pay a little more copay. So I'll work on that, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you. Representative O'Trimble.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's part of what the problem is that we tried to do some changes for farmers, and the feds are not giving us a waiver. And I've written to absolutely everybody at the federal level, from Klobuchar to whoever, and we still can't get it done. So even when we pass it, it still doesn't happen. And even if you buy a $10,000 health savings account, they don't have any money to put into it.
Any further discussion? You want to testify too? All right. Come on up. We're going to vote on it very shortly, though.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, sorry for the delay. My name is Jeff Barsh, representing Health Partners. Not necessarily to the bill before us today, but given Representative Finch's comments from others and the discussion we had a couple days ago on this committee, I just want to be real clear on the record that the companies aren't here asking to offer this policy, and I don't want to be back here in a few years with a bill that's requiring us to offer this policy if it's not something that is attractive out in the marketplace. Just wanted to state that for the record.
Okay, I had a question on a different subject. There's some issue with health plans where if a person in the house needs to be put into an inpatient mental health facility, they're at that level of need, but the health plans are requiring a step up as they go there, so they have to go through the hoop, even though the psychiatrist has determined they need to be inpatient, but they have to put them in an outpatient facility first and stuff. Are you aware of that issue at all?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to something in the TMAP or Minnesota Care program? Or
no,
an issue
commercial market.
Commercially?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with what you're talking about specifically, but I'd be happy to discuss
okay.
it.
Okay, I think we should. Okay. All right. All right, any further discussion on this bill? All right, all in favor, I'll renew my motion that House File 3243 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right, and then I will move that House File 3410 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Commerce. And we had discussion of this previously, members. Are there questions on the legislation? Representative Abel.
I have to change gears. I'm sorry. So this is, and again, I appreciate the innovation of the author and these Berkshire Alliance folks, and I know you have some great ideas, and it's, and I'm supportive of a lot of good ideas, just to throw them out there, but this is going to require money from the Healthcare Access Fund, which, and actually the House has yet to act on what the governor would do. The governor proposes you as the leadership in the House get to dispose, so I would predict that that money may not be leading the Healthcare Access Fund, but who knows, whatever happens, but this requires money from the Healthcare Access Fund as an ongoing contribution, right? This is an annual appropriation to pay for this from the Healthcare. Is that my first question?
Mr. Chair, it does have a sunset provision that nevertheless expires in 2013.
Okay. And so for that period of 6 years or whatever, it would go out at five or whatever the time is. And then at the end of that time, then the people who are getting the benefit would have to bear that cost themselves. Is there a ramp-up provision you got in here to pay for that?
Representative, it's general fund, not the Healthcare Access Fund.
It's the appropriation from the Healthcare Access Fund in the bill.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Okay, I have two different opinions. You're right, you're the chair.
I'm just reading it.
Okay.
So.
Okay, sorry, Representative. Go ahead.
And so, well, Mr. Chair, and it's good to create the chair when you're at this table. That's a smart move. You're right, Mr. Chair. Is there a provision in the program to put some money aside so that there's not a big jump of premium, 10 or 11% or whatever it's going to be in 2013?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to be candid with you, I think the approach of this bill is to say where is the market failure right now in these rural areas, and if we could jumpstart this process by having a state-subsidized stop-loss fund that would encourage and allow more a fully insured partner to work with Berkshire Alliances to come in. Once these people are fully insured and they've been on the rolls for 6 years, they have different health experience data, we see that that problem will need to be readdressed in 2013. But the idea here is that it's a little bit like seed money that you're throwing at the private market. In other words, here we'll increase the incentives, because right now our experience has been, we did a request for information to fully insured partners that are licensed to offer healthcare insurance in Minnesota, didn't get a lot of results, a lot of response. In the absence of incentives, there's some reluctance of fully insured partners to come in and offer insurance to small businesses, less than 10 employees, haven't had health insurance for the last 12 months. So the idea is here, let's provide some seed money, jumpstart the process. The fully insured partner is kind of interested because, hey, the state will cover the liability between $30,000 and $100,000. 2013 takes us to a little different time frame. You know, theoretically, yeah, but you'd have different experience rating because a bunch of people now have had actual health care insurance. We believe there'd be an improvement in actuarial data, which in our opinion also kind of discriminates against rural people. There's less, the things that are done by actuaries with farmers in this country have been studied by researchers. It's not good. It's compared with very dissimilar groups. It would help some of those market problems get corrected as there'd be more experience data. So I wouldn't project that it would produce real strong increases in premiums even in 2013, but we'd open the door to maybe look at what's the experience up to 2011 and look at what might be needed. Is a stop-loss fund continuation going to be needed? Would it be worth it to do a second wave of this to encourage, again, people who haven't had insurance in the last 12 months, and those people would be eligible to come in at that point, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. I appreciate trying to help people move into the private sector, and actually the seed stuff works better at the Ag Committee than the Health Committee, but I kind of understand where you're going with the seed thing, being a suburban member. But can you compare this to the state simply subsidizing an existing reinsurance product, and why would you set up a whole new fund, and compare this to buying, shopping around on the web and finding the bargain reinsurance for that range of $30,000 to $100,000?
Yeah, Mr. Carter, Representative, I think the approach here is very similar to what happened in the Healthy New York program. Most folks who are doing a lot of stuff with trying to tinker with the private market look at the reinsurance options as being a real opportunity to produce to insure more people who are currently uninsured. So the difference here, of course, is that the state is providing the reinsurance coverage against this group that the private market is reluctant to offer insurance to. And there's a lot of data that would suggest that they're not as scary, those rural people, as the market might be saying in terms of what the actuaries are saying.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just a comment, then I'm done. I'm going to support this today, and I hope you find the money. But as this goes along, I think you might want to create an option to the author to set up what you think it might cost and see if the private market could bid. And because I heard when I worked on this and with my little division, I heard the market was robust for reinsurance, and there's never a problem. But I'm convinced there's a problem, and I hope you can get your problem solved.
And Ms. Coleman, do you want to test that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would just like to add a couple comments. First of all, we're throwing the term reinsurance around here pretty loosely. This is not reinsurance. This is not stop loss. This is simply shifting the liability from the premium payers to the state. And so I think that we need to be very clear on this. We did run the numbers at Medica to look at what the impact, and we did this among, this is a very narrow, but we looked at the entire small group market. It would lower premiums by 11 to 13%. That is a significant amount, no doubt about it, as the small employers who are struggling. The question that we have and the concern that we have is at the point, as we know, we do have budget crises up here at the Capitol. They're constantly fighting for money. And so what happens when the state says they can no longer afford to subsidize this $30,000 to $100,000 mark? They put that back to the insurers, which is back to the premium payers. It's passed through in the premiums that are paid. And these groups are going to get a significant bump. So 11 to 13% savings is a one-time saving. After that, their increases are going to be exactly what the rest of the market's experience increases, taking into account a portion of that based on their own experience. And so when the state says, we can't afford this anymore, they'll get that increase, plus the additional increase that will come from this. So again, in some ways, I would say this idea, if we were flushed with cash, to have the state take some of the liability to take it off the back of small employers is not a bad idea. This is actually better than reinsurance, because reinsurance actually adds more administrative costs. You just shift the money from one part of your premium to the other. This is not reinsurance. You're not paying an additional premium, only, I guess, in as much as a taxpayer of Minnesota. That would be spread. So that was the only comment I wished to have on this bill. Thank you.
Did you know how much the 11 to 13%, did you do any costing of that?
On what?
How much that would?
The 11 to 13% dollar amount was based on the entire small employer market. Not, we didn't have any information on this specific Alliance Stop Loss Fund. Across the entire market, it would be between $150 million and $200 million for the Health Care Action Fund.
Further questions? Representative Gottwald. Oh, Mr. Thorson, did you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and a very important correction. This would not be available to the entire small business market. It's just for purchasing alliances. You might be looking at this as more like a demonstration project to see if actually this works in rural areas, to put a small amount of seed money to see if that actually produces the incentives to partner with fully insured partners for personal alliances to do that. And just add that there's also another piece of this. It's not just the 11 to 13%, which is an important part to make it an affordable plan. It's also to encourage fully insured partners to work with rural residents, rural small businesses, to insure them, to develop better relationships and actuarial data, because they're not, it's not the easiest market. It's not a market that they're as accustomed to dealing with as the large, more suburban and urban markets.
How many lives are covered in purchasing alliances right now?
Yeah, what we projected out in terms of some budgeting on this, would be approximately 3,000. We would start with about 3,000 bodies and probably cap it at that in terms of what we do.
Okay.
So that would estimate about $6 million in cost.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too am open to these kinds of explorations, but to keep in mind again that this is precedent setting. If the state is going to start providing reinsurance for groups of people, where does it end? Rural people are one group. We could probably identify dozens of other groups, and the state could try to buy down the cost of health care coverage through this model. But, you know, there's been other ideas floated, things like tax credits or vouchers, too, to people based on need. Could be used to buy down the cost of coverage and make it simpler for health plans to work with them if they know they can cover their costs, and these people would be able to purchase it at a savings. So there are some other ways we could approach the affordability issue short of doing this. I'm just concerned about the precedence of the state being left holding the bag, if you will.
President Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, Representative Peterson, I think this is really, you know, it's great that you're bringing these ideas forward, and I just want to comment that on the one hand, the previous testifier is saying, oh no, you know, we shouldn't do it because it might not go on forever, and then Representative Gottwald was saying, oh no, we shouldn't do it because we'll be setting a precedent. You know, I think that, first of all, as I'm looking at this summary that we got from House Research, it says that this program's expired. So it was something that was in place before. I'm sorry, I came in a little bit late, so maybe you already said that. But so it's not a precedent. It's something that's been done before, so the precedent is already there. So, I mean, maybe there are other problems with it. I don't know, but I wouldn't hang my hat on that one.
President Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I believe the reason it no longer exists is it was abolished. It was taken away. It was done away with. And my concern in reintroducing it is we've seen not only this initiative, but other initiatives here at the legislature this session and the previous session to have the state subsidize, underwrite, provide funds to help support pools. Pooling is not a bad idea, again, when it comes to moderating costs, but it does not ultimately lower costs. And if, as the previous testifier pointed out, this is a short-term thing that could leave people without that benefit down the road, then I have some concerns about it as well. But the overall cost to the state and the fact that if it works for this pool, how many other pools are we going to be providing reinsurance to? That is a concern, and it is a precedent.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, the philosophical approach to this is actually that for most of these recipients that work in small businesses in rural Minnesota with less than 10 employees who have not been offered health care insurance for the last 12 months, a large percentage of them are on Minnesota Care right now. This is a potential for a significant cost saver of moving people off of government Minnesota Care to encouraging fully insured partners to work with the small businesses of rural Minnesota to develop an affordable health care product that they can market to and provide to their employees. So I see it a little bit differently.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3410 be recommended pass and referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you for coming today. And good luck getting back to
where Thank you, Mr. Chair, for being generous with your time today.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Okay.
All right. Representative Tao, do you want to move the... are these both your bills as well? You can go up there. Well, either way. Yeah. First, Representative Tao will move adoption of the licensing subcommittee report on 3592. It's 3592 CR1. All those in favor of the committee adopting that report say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Mm-hmm. All right. Then Representative Tao.
Mr. Chair, members, I have an amendment. I'd like to put the amendment on first and then...
Let's move the bill first.
Chair? Oh,
yes. Yeah.
We're not finding the licensing report. Is it in a separate area?
It's just the first page. This is what we just
the
adopted.
One page.
And then I'll move the actual bill, 3592, okay. That it be recommended passed and referred to finance.
Thank you.
And then you have an amendment.
Okay.
I do. I have the A2... And why don't I remove the A2 on, and then, because it's pretty big, and then I'll explain the bill as it is with the A2 on it. So,
okay. Representative Powell moves the A2 amendment to get in the form he wishes it to be. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. And members, kind of consistent with how we've done this in the past. Residence Health can briefly support the bill. A lot of work was done in this in the licensing subcommittee, and I don't think we need to take a whole lot of time here, but with the amendment, why don't you present that?
Why don't I explain the bill a little bit, and then we'll take a vote on right afterwards. Essentially, this established a roster of all available interpreters that we could begin to quantify the supply of interpreters, medical interpreters, in Minnesota here. Eventually, it's going to develop a registry for interpreters, which will include standards for quality and language proficiency. The Department of Health shall consult with the Interpreter Service Group, which is a long-standing group of the Upper Midwest Translators and Interpreters Association, during this process. This bill will also require the development of a certification process based on national standards. And the stakeholders and I have been working on to move this bill forward. I've been also working with the staff from the Department of Health as well. And essentially this bill will move to improve medical interpreting for a lot of the non-English speakers in our system. And you'll probably wonder, why do we need this bill? And the answer is yes.
Any clarifying questions on the bill? Okay, seeing none. Representative Tyler renews his motion that House File 3592 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. And before we get to Representative Tyler's next bill, I'd like to move House File 3009, which is Representative Morrow has a bill for a nursing home in his district. We have dealt with this issue in the past and other nursing homes. The policy is we've dealt with this policy for Representative Anzalos had a bill, I think, last year. It's just to allow them to account for private pension benefits. You know, they used to be public and they went to private, and so, but they're still in the PARA program, and it's an accounting issue we've dealt with in the past. So I'd like to just move it on to finance if we could. So I'm going to just make the motion that we re-refer without recommendation House File 3009 to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, thank you. Representative Tao, 2837, I guess we should move the licensing subcommittee report first. Representative Tao will do that. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The report is adopted. Representative Tao, you want to move House File 2837?
Yes.
And that's going to be recommended pass to the General Register?
That's right. I want to move 2837 to the General Register. I know there's an amendment in there. We're not going to take it up, because if we do, it'll have to go to Commerce. It's also introduced as a standalone bill, the amendment. So I'll pick that up in Commerce, and eventually the two bills will merge as one when we get to the floor. Let me explain the bill. There's three things that this bill does. One, the bill consolidates the definition of optometrist. This language was first written in 1915 and has not changed a lot since then. Additional language allowing optometrists to diagnose and treat eye conditions was added in different sections. This brings the definitions together. Two, the bill consolidates the licensure process from three steps to one. Currently, optometrists are licensed and then receive separate certification to use drops to diagnose and a third certification to prescribe medication to treat condition of the eye. This is simply an administrative change, since all optometrists receiving license also receive additional levels of certification. Since the early 1990s, all optometrists graduated from the College of Optometry have been certified at all three levels. And the administrative process of separate certification is no longer necessary. And thirdly, the legislation allows for the board to accept transferee license from other states under an endorsement process rather than the reciprocity.
process. We've been working with the Board of Optometry as well as the Academy of Ophthalmology for the past year. So, members, there's peace in the valley with this bill.
Representative Naylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually happy to hear that. There's been some non-peace in the valley years about that. This amendment, is this also, is that also, everybody's cool with that?
This amendment has already been worked out with all the groups, but I don't want to, because of short time, I don't want to send this to Congress and have it not get a hearing because of lack of time. So
I was just asking, Mr. Chair, just for the controversy amendment. I'm happy there's agreement on that, too. It's just so far and away the best way when all the groups can work out their differences, not make us pick a favorite. So thank you. Good work, Representative Powell. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions on this bill? All right. Representative Powell will renew his motion that 2837 be recommended passed and sent to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Peterson. Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 3812 be recommended to pass. I don't remember where it goes.
Okay.
To state and local government. To local government. Right. To Representative Hillstrom's committee. And I also have a delete, an A1 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment. I'd like to move that and put it in the form that we can talk about it. And before we do that, I do have an oral amendment that I'd like to put on there before we adopt the amendment. And that's on line 2.6 of the A1 amendment. After 2009, add the word without a gravity outlet or drain, comma. Without a gravity outlet or drain, comma. And all that's doing is allowing, it would just allow pools to be constructed either with the gravity outlet and drain, or if it's not constructed that way under these new standards. And we can talk more about that later if people want to. So if we could just put that on.
After 2009, without a gravity outlet or drain.
And I'd like to incorporate that.
And you'd like to incorporate that? All in favor of that oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Okay.
And then we can just put the amendment on, too? Or did we do that?
We haven't. Okay. To the amendments, members, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Amended.
Okay. Thank you, members. This is legislation related to pool safety. You know, as too often happens sometimes, the legislature gets awareness of an issue after, in response to it, after a tragedy has happened. And you probably are all familiar with Abigail Taylor's story, and this is response to that unfortunate tragedy. It made the health department and others take a look at our current pool safety regulations, and they saw that there could be improvements made. So this bill is an attempt to do that, and it does just does that in several ways. The first thing, and kind of the biggest context piece, is it expands the definition of what types of pools are licensed. Expands the definition of public pools, and that's on line 3.15, that you can find that definition. Currently, I believe, we're limited to pools that have food associated with them or a hotel kind of thing. This would expand them to all pools where the public has access, and you can read the definition of what would be included there. So kind of within that context then, what it does, when a new pool is submitted for licensing after January 1st of next year, and this process is already in law that you'd have to do this, but we're adding a requirement that a professional engineer has to have signed off on the pool drawings. It increases some fees, as you'll see on page one, to help pay for the additional inspections that will happen and some other things in the bill, and for reviewing the plans, these kind of engineering plans. The third thing is for new construction, it will put in some requirements, and this is somewhat similar to what happened at the federal level as well, so we're making it consistent. Consistent with that, with federal legislation, either it has to be this gravity outlet or drain. And if you have wading pools in some, like in Minneapolis, for instance, we have these, and maybe in some of your communities, there's actually not a suction as part of it, but it's just a gravity drain, and then the water's pumped up. You know, the water flows into some kind of chamber beneath the pool, and then it's pumped up, but there's no actual vacuum suction. So you can either do that style of drain, or if you're going to have a suction pump, a drain, a suction outlet. You have to have two of them, so if one gets blocked, we don't run into some of the problems that we saw. So it puts in construction standards for new construction, and it also is going to require upgrades of old pools. And one of the differences between this amendment and the original bill is we've actually moved out the dates for those from 2009 for shallow pools to 2010, and then for all other pools from 2010 to 2011. So we're giving more time to do that. And we're also changing it in this to allow for the gravity or outlet drain type pools to still exist. And then the last big piece here is that there will be, we're adding a requirement, and there are in rule, current rule by the Department of Health, things that have to be happen every day at pools. This would add in a new requirement that to actually check the drain and outlets on a daily basis. And so that's really what the bill does, members.
Questions? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, thanks for bringing this forward. I think we are all familiar with the incident. I hope that it never happens to anyone else again, and I know this is meant to accomplish that. Just some technical questions.
And maybe we have the Department of Health come up, too, if that's all
right. Great. Just real quickly, do we know how many pools this is going to, I mean, do we know where these pools are? Are we going to have to find them? Do we have a good understanding of where they are and how they'll be inspected to make sure they comply?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Langstein, the Director for Environmental Health with Minnesota Department of Health. We are the licensing and inspection authority pursuant to the commissioner's authority in law, and there are also delegations with local units of government who license and inspect swimming pools in the state. Currently, the Department of Health licenses about 1,000 public swimming pools in the state. There's probably the impact of this amendment in the law will draw in 700 additional, we anticipate, public swimming pools. That expansion is largely due to pools that are not associated with a food, beverage, or lodging facility at the present time. Those would be community pools, they might be health clubs, YMCAs, other facilities such as residential apartment complexes and so forth that are currently, some local units of government pass ordinances and do license and inspect those. The state currently does not. We estimate total number of pools in the state that would be licensed and inspected by either the local government or the State Department of Health would be approximately 4,000 total.
And Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I'm thinking practically in terms of, number one, the time. I appreciate the fact that time frames have been moved out. I think that's beneficial. But the cost that these facilities are going to bear in updating these, it's not arguing that they shouldn't be updated. I think we do want to prevent this kind of thing. But obviously, there's going to be some cost to retrofitting.
Yes. Madam Chair, if I could comment on that, Representative Gottwald, we estimate the cost of retrofitting, depending upon the size and the type of the pool, to range between $2,000 and $10,000 per pool. Average cost of an average size pool in a facility that would be the residential apartment complex of that type, probably around $5,000.
One more question, Madam Chair. Do we know how many of these are old? Obviously, the number you've given us is for existing pools, correct, that would need to be retrofitted, about 4,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, no, that's okay. Not necessarily true. That's the total number that would be subject to licensure in the state. A significant number of those are already licensed and inspected. About 700 of them are currently not licensed.
some of those 700 will meet the requirements, some will not, just as some of the existing pools that are under license will meet the requirements, some will not. So we don't have a reliable estimate for you at this time in terms of the numbers of pools that will have to be retrofitted.
And maybe it would be worthwhile, Matt, if the testifier could talk, Mr. Stein could talk about the three types of possibilities there are, what an unblockable suction outlet and drain is.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Thiessen.
I don't know.
Madam Chair, I can speak to that. A large unblockable drain under the code and under our rules is a sufficiently large drain that it would not be possible for a human body to block that drain. So it is I don't have the exact dimensions, but it's roughly 2 feet by 3 feet. It's a significant space that would be difficult for a human body to block. The other is a gravity drain. Gravity drains are just like what you have in your bathtub. There's no suction on the drain. When you put your hand on the drain, there's a little bit of suction as the water evacuates the drain line, or perhaps if you put your thumb over the end of a straw and draw it up out of the glass and there's that little bit of suction there on your finger, there's a minor amount of suction, but it's not a risk to health or safety. And then the third option, I believe, is two parallel suction outlets with compliant covers. As we know from reports of the accident that occurred, that the cover and suction outlets are the most dangerous kind of drain system. So to have two of those drains connected in parallel means that it would be very unlikely and difficult to block both of them simultaneously. So those are the safest approaches to providing for drain systems in public swimming pools.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Abler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen and or whichever. Are the owners of these pools going to be surprised, or are they kind of getting a hint that they have to start thinking about this, since this is sort of anticipated for most of these owners?
Madam Chair, the only thing that I can respond to is I have had conversations with the multi-unit housing folks, and as this moves forward, we'll continue those discussions. So they, at least their organization, I think the apartment buildings are probably the biggest group of folks that would fall in that 700, and at least their organization is aware of it, and I don't know how much is filtered out, so to speak, I suppose, from there, but we'll continue to work with them to make sure that, I understand the practical challenges of this.
And Madam Chair, it seems like I didn't listen to all your amendments, but there's some dates for June 1, 2008.
We moved those out.
Sure,
a year.
Okay.
June 1, 2008, no, those are not.
The drain covers and all that.
That they have to have the drain covers.
And are those just normal things they should have been doing all along?
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, that's really to address the interim step of before the new drain covers are available on the market, before pools have retrofitted their drain systems, we want to make sure that the operators of those pools are daily physically inspecting those drains. So that's really when the June 1, 2008 date kicks in. It's for the assurance that there's some interim steps going on to look at the safety and operation of the pool on a daily basis.
And just one last question. I have a new enhanced sensitivity to fees and taxes. I don't know why they're so all of a sudden, but call me crazy. I noticed that is the spa fee going to go down? Was it $1,000 and now it's $500?
Madam Chair, Representative Ayler, no. The fees are not changed. They're just reorganized. If you look at what the old language was and what the new language is, they're the exact same fees for the exact same types of pools. They're just ordered differently. So there's no change in the fee structure. But the change that will occur is we'll license additional pools, and that will generate additional revenue.
I guess I have a specific question. I thought I was done. But like it says on line 118, eight spa pools cross off, and it used to be a 500 for that, but then it was an additional 500 on line 122. And it looks like it's just one $500 fee for a spa pool now. Is that... Are they still paying $1,000 for a spa pool?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, if you look at what for each, it's just reorganized. The fees remain exactly the same.
Okay.
They're going to pay $500.
Yeah. Well, didn't they pay $1,000 before, though?
number two used to not relate to spa pools,
right.
So they just bumped spa pools up from sub part two to number two.
All right,
it's a I was confused. Yeah,
I think I'll let it go.
Okay, Representative Thiessen to the bill. I'm sorry, Representative Gottwald had a question.
Madam Chair, thanks. Just one other question for clarification. This would include things like hotel pools, the hospitality industry. Those people are going to have to get with this, obviously.
Right?
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, yes. And we've had conversations with their association, and they are aware that these changes are being discussed.
Good. We know that.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We know that this probably would not prevent an accident from ever happening, but obviously it's, these are some common sense things that would help prevent the likelihood.
Thank you. And any other questions, members? With that, Representative Thiessen?
I'll just renew my motion.
Okay, renew the motion of House File 3812, members, to be referred to local government. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. The ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank
you. Okay. Representative Winkler, please come up. Welcome to the committee, Representative Winkler. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I guess first I would hope that somebody could move the bill to the General Register.
Would you like to move the bill, Representative Bunn?
I would be glad to move the bill, House File 3654, authored by Winkler, to the General Register.
And Madam Chair, there are two amendments to the bill.
Okay.
Both are A8. One is A8-1353 and the other is
A8-1352.
I hope that you have them.
Yep. Do the members have those amendments, A8-1353 and A8-1352?
Yes.
Amendment would you like to take first, Representative Winkler?
I'll take 1352. I guess we'll move the motion to that.
To the amendment.
Madam Chair, members, basically, I'll just give you a quick overview of what this bill does. It provides workers' compensation and liability coverage to health volunteers who come to the aid who work through the state of Minnesota and work in aid disasters. It basically means that people who are health professionals who want to go to someplace in Minnesota locally or to another state, that if they are called by the Commissioner of Health to provide those services, they will be covered by those states. Workers' compensation and liability policies, so that those people who are doing the volunteering aren't taking the risk of their own livelihood for doing so. And the 8-1352 amendment is part of that, and it simply authorizes people who are out-of-state medical workers to come and work in Minnesota if they're registered through this national registry for volunteer medical corps personnel.
Well, thank you, Representative Winkler. Members, let's adopt the AA 1353 amendment. All in favor?
Madam Chair, can we talk about it first? Okay.
Go ahead. Question.
Where's this bill going after this goes on? To civil law or somewhere?
To the floor?
Madam Chair, this bill can't go to the floor with this amendment. Is there a court? I did the Emergency Powers Act thing, and Representative Winkler, just understand. I saw every committee there was in this house. It's about, and
been there.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Other things, but tort liability and all that is not a small matter to throw into a bill. This is what you call a killer amendment, and it sends you on a direction you may or may not want to go. Is this bill moving in the Senate?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, it is. It will meet the first deadline, I believe, in the Senate. But the word I've had from the Public Safety and Civil Justice Chair is that he does not need to see it.
You got to be kidding.
Representative Abler.
I'm not kidding you, Representative Abler.
It's great to have a chair like you. But this is not a small matter. I'm just telling you. I think we should protect these folks, but there's all kinds of questions that this raises about what they did and who they hurt and were they capable of doing what they said they could do. I sat in the still, that's why. And we almost lost the bill over tort issues. And so, what your side wants to do with who they go see is fine, but I'm just telling you as the author that this is not a small matter, and there's a lot of questions this raises and a lot of liability that opens up to the state, which you're dealing with now on another liability matter. So I'm just kind of surprised that nobody wants to see this, and they're just going to say you can have tort liability exceptions, so, or protections. So I'm willing to support the amendment, but I'm just surprised that we're not going to scrutinize it a bit more. So, thanks.
That's the only
question. The A1352 amendment. Madam Chair, members, first of all, I want to be clear that this subdivision 8, which is the underlying text here, is from a uniform, it's the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act. It's a uniform code that is being promoted in a number of different states. This is a provision from a bill that Representative Thiessen was going to carry. We both had a Medical Reserve Corps bill, and we both had a pool safety bill, and we divided them up. So I'm adopting this amendment from his original bill, which is part of a uniform national effort.
Any other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I haven't read the bill. I appreciate what you're trying to do. We need to have volunteers in times of peacetime emergencies and disasters and so on. One of the real problems we had with our bill was who can do what where, who can be protected, and what expectation does the recipient of the service that's getting the volunteer service have that the person knows what to do? And it's a real question, and we spent a lot of time. And I think we were arguing about the cap on tort. Is it the municipal cap, which I know you know all about now, and all that stuff. And so can you maybe just tell me offhand what these credentials for these volunteers are? Are they like licensed medical doctors or physician assistants or first responders? And are there a scope what they can do right within those normal scopes we expect them to be? Is that what you're building
up? Representative Winsor, I do think we have the Department of Health.
This is an important piece of legislation. Like.
Madam Chair, Representative Aper, basically what this does is create a partnership and a planning process between local health departments and the state to develop a volunteer base. Currently there are about 7,000 of them in Minnesota. And I believe that they are tasked with doing their specific job. I mean, we joked in the audience about neurosurgeons. I don't know that we're doing a lot of neurosurgery at a disaster site, for example. But we're talking about health professionals being assigned to projects that are within their capacity of their expertise.
We have welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your...
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. And I want to first clarify with Representative Abler the difference between the bill that you carried and the one that we're doing today. That one was about liability issues about systems, the hospital, the nursing home, the emergency medical services system, and the liability that they would have during the disaster, that they would have a special protection when their systems are overwhelmed. This bill is about individual volunteers who apply to and are accepted by a registry that is operated by either a unit of local government or the University of Minnesota or Mayo Clinic. So they are brought in, their credentials are reviewed and evaluated, they are provided some training, and if they are deployed, they are deployed under the direct control and supervision of either the unit of government or for the bill that we're talking about under the Commissioner's Health. So there's a different kind of standard and a different kind of interaction. And they would be considered more individual volunteers.
And Madam Chair?
Mrs. Aber.
Ms. Lighthizer was directly associated with many years of the Emergency Powers Act, and so I'm really glad she's here today. She's really done a lot of work on this. So you can ask her a few questions, so I appreciate you having that. She's a good witness for this bill. That's my link. Is there some comfort, or some assurance that the people who are registered will be given duties that they're capable of, and the tort liability that they're going to be, or coverage they'll be getting, will be correctly given to them for what they should have known how to do?
Madam Representative Abler, because we would have them register ahead of time, we'd evaluate their credential, are they a nurse practitioner, are they a nurse, are they a veterinarian, we will know ahead of time. And when we're asking for volunteers, we would identify them and can contact them individually, as opposed to the previous system before we developed this particular program.
we would ask for volunteers. People would come in. We wouldn't know who they were or how to verify them. These are verified and credentialed volunteers who've agreed to work with us in the system. So they would be assigned duties commensurate with their expertise, background, license, and skills.
And Madam Chair.
That's the main purpose.
And so that's the purpose of the registry, so they'd be all be pre-selected, and you'd kind of know what their skill set was. And
The federal name of the program is the Emergency System for the Advanced Registration of Volunteer Health Professionals, which is the worst acronym in history. We start this. The purpose is that people sign up ahead of time, and so we know who they are, and we can contact them, and we monitor that their credentials are up to date. In fact, that's one of the provisions here, is that if they're not, if their license has been revoked, that they're not able to access the protections provided here.
And Madam Chair, the author wouldn't know because he wasn't here, but I question almost everything that's had to do with it. They want us to comply with it. I think we do stuff better sometimes. And in the Emergency Health Powers Act, I think we came up with a really good bill when we put our Minnesota thinking hats on and protected people from all kinds of harm that I saw. So I'll trust the good witness you have who's worked on this enough points. I think you've got a good idea here, and I'll support it today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. To the amendment, the 52 amendment, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think of the very good work that I think has been done in emergency response since Y2K, and particularly since 911, and I've been associated with some of that in the central part of our state. I'm wondering how this coordinates or collaborates with or jibes with the extensive efforts statewide. I know there's been a great deal of planning and collaboration going on among emergency response people. Marvin Kluge up in our area of the state to get the state ready for emergencies. So help me get up to speed on how this jives with that. Does it duplicate anything?
Just testify.
Madam Chair and Representatives, the Medical Reserve Corps proposal that you have in front of you as part of the bill is really about health volunteers. We've had systems in place for a variety of volunteers, whether it's to do sandbagging or assist with house tear downs, those kinds of things. What we found as a whole for the volunteer health provider, who usually doesn't work for government or is part of the health system, and they have concerns about their workers' compensation when they are volunteering and about their liability. And the system that we are proposing, the Minnesota Response Medical Reserve Corps, is built on systems throughout the state. So every county has developed some kind of a system and a registry that we're hooking together. So if we need volunteers, and we did for Southeast Minnesota, we're able to call on volunteers from other parts of the state. This makes it an official program, knits it together, and I think provides us the ability to track the quality of the volunteers.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's a great idea. What is the total cost on this?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, the cost is all borne by a federal grant, and the language of the bill actually specifies that to the extent you're receiving grant funding, you have to comply with the provisions of the bill. And so there actually is no fiscal impact for Minnesota.
Any other questions, members? If not, let's go to the amendment, the 52. All in favor of that amendment? Who's going to move the amendment? Representative Abler?
I'll move it.
So moved. And members, to the amendment, all in favor, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Madam Chair, the other one, sir.
And to the 53 amendment, so moved. Members, all in favor, just by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendments are adopted. Representative Winkler, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members, I think that we've covered the substance of the bill in discussing the amendments, and if there are any further questions, we'll be happy to take them.
Any further questions, members? I understand that this is going to public safety now. Floor, pardon me. We're back at the floor. All right. It is sharp turn. But I just want to say also thank you very much for working on this, and Madam, from testifier, you as well, and a lot of us who are nurses and still maintain our license and our CPR status, we all ought to think about volunteering when we go back home.
So again, the brochures, if you'd like to sign.
Okay, thank you. I'll take a look. Thank you. Members, to the bill. We haven't voted on it yet. Okay, we're going to vote on the bill. House file number 3654 to go to the floor. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
The bill is going to the floor. Representative Winkler, good work. Representative Madore. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Walker, will you move the committee, the division report on 3576?
Mr. Chair, I move the committee division report on House File 3576, the Madore bill.
Okay. Any discussion on that? All in favor of adopting the committee report, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, that motion prevails. And Representative Walker, will you move that House File 3576 be recommended passed and re-refer to the General Register?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House File 3576 be passed and recommended to the General Register.
Representative Madore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Basically, this bill, we heard it in mental health, and it relates to the ability of the Ombudsman to collect copies of reports with regard to an investigation for a deceased person. It's a pretty straightforward bill. It just expands their ability to gather that information. And I have a testifier here, and in the queue of time, I'll just go ahead and let her testify.
Welcome.
Kevin Thiessen and members of the committee, I'm Roberta O'Brien, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I would only correct one thing. This doesn't expand anything. This is just a technical clarifying language. For 20 years, we've gotten copies when we're conducting our reviews or investigations. We've looked at the records. We're not asking for any new authority. But simply during the course of the review, we might say we need copies of these five pages of a record. And that's worked very well for 20 years. We've been doing the death reviews for the entire time the agency's been around. But recently, a rather abrupt change in the interpretation of our statute led one agency to make the determination that because the word copies was not included, that we couldn't get copies. We could come in, we could look at. But as a state agency, we're obligated to keep records of the information that we have, the actions that we do. We only have 17 people to cover 12,000 facilities in the state of Minnesota. So the idea that we could look at them and then if we needed to go recheck them becomes a driving impossibility. We're working with the agency that came up or change their interpretation of law, but even if we develop something with one agency, again, there's 12,000 total facilities. So if we don't have the word copies in there, it pretty much puts a halt to our work because we can't keep the records the auditor requires us to keep. Everything else in the language besides the word copies is housekeeping language. It was developed by the Department of Administration's IFO Policy Office. Katie English here, if you have any questions as to whether it expands authority or clarifies authority, she could answer that.
Any questions, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Madore. For my clarification, are there other ombudsmen who have this federal designation, this federal health oversight agency designation? Is that true on a state level or a national level?
The Ombudsman for Older Minnesotans has been determined to be a health oversight organization. I don't know whether, in general, the federal government has said we believe that ombudsmen, if they're duly authorized by the state government, would be considered a health oversight organization. Whether they've gone to the trouble to name everyone that might be around the country, I don't know.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Walker will renew her motion that House File 3576 be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thanks. And Representative Walker, will you move the division report on House File 3147?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the division report on House File 3147.
All right. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Frick, you want to move your bill? And I think it's going to finance. House File, okay.
Yes, I would like to move that.
House File 3147, we recommend a pass and refer to finance. To the bill.
This is a work group feasibility study, which we're asking. The work group shall include stakeholders, case providers, Minnesota Ambulance Associations, and this is for a mental health working group that will, it's a working group to study access to emergency mental health services.
And I'm assuming we had a thorough discussion in the division?
We did. Oh, yes.
Okay. Right, any questions? Representative Abler.
I was out in the hall. Sorry. Is this going to finance or to the
floor?
Yeah,
finance.
Okay.
Finance.
Mm-hmm. Does the department like it? This is then, I think, if they like it. So.
They don't object.
Cool.
Is what I know. Understand.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Fitzgerald will renew her motion that House File 3147 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. We're in recess till 6 p.m. here in this room.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome back. We have the minutes to approve. Let's see, Representative Finster, would you like to? All right.
I'll move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Oh. I'm going to let you come in.
Oh, all in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Also,
no.
All right.
Two to one.
Oh, every few times. All right. I'll move House File 45. Division report from the fellows. The division report from the mental health division. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. And I'll move House File 2588, the recommended pass to the General Register. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. There is an amendment. Did you get that?
Here we have it, yep. I will move the
DE1
amendment. Just to get the kicked off, there would like it. I'll assume that amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2588 is in response to the Children, Adolescent, Behavior Health Services Program in Brainerd being closed down. In your packet, you have some very compelling testimony from psychiatrists, social workers, and a parent, a former resident consumer of the Brainerd CAS program. This program serves much of central Minnesota and northern Minnesota, helping children and adolescents who are having major, major mental health issues like suicide, depression, cutting themselves, other behaviors which are extremely difficult to deal with. CAD Brainerd program and staff, as you can see from the testimony, is of high quality, taking the most difficult clients that no one else would take. Most importantly, they make a huge impact and difference with these children and their families. When it became clear that the Department of Human Services and State Operating Services were considering closing this program down, I and Representative Al Junkie repeatedly asked that we and the staff from the program be involved in the process. When our local school districts need to start making cuts, they went to the people who know the system best. That's the staff asking for suggestions input, and through that process we're able to make not as many cuts as we thought were necessary. Instead of DHS and SOS never listening or allowing any input from anyone and making the decisions on what I would call misinformation, such as bed counts, dollars, revenues, percent of referrals from the metro area. They made those decisions based on that, and that was some misinformation. I was told, for example, the decision would be made on based on the bed count report, and the decision was not going to be made before that report came out. In fact, the decision was made before that came, that report came out. So those decisions, which greatly impact some of our most needy children and their families, were made with some misinformation. I have a report from a social worker that says that we're now sending kids to North Dakota rather than, you know, to our Minnesota schools, because right now only in the state there's one program that's offered, one CAS program that's offered, and that's in Wilmer. So even though, you know, I keep getting information from Tom Lehman that says, you know, the number of mental health beds, we need more. The report that DHS and SLS continue to talk about is underutilization. So, also, when they closed down the Brainerd CAS program, it was capacity of 20 residents at each one. And so when they closed down the Brainerd and went to the Wilmer one, because it was just the Wilmer one, we now have a capacity of 26 beds, only just improving the capacity to 6. That just is not meeting the needs of our kids in central and northern Minnesota. The families are having to travel more to provide just to visit their child, to be involved in the service. So House File 2588, Mr. Chair and members, would make it so that DHS and SOS must get legislation approval. And the reason I bring up CAS is because I'm relating to why the decision that was made, why I came forth with this legislation. So House File 2588 would make it so that Department of Human Services and State Operating Services must get legislative approval before closing, relocating, or implementing any change in a enterprise program. If these plans are good for the children and the families, then DHS and SLS would have no problem sharing them and being transparent with the legislature for approval. I ask for your support, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, I'm thankful that you're still bringing this bill forward. While it still does not directly address the issues that are going on back at home for you with your community, and then those that utilize the services right around your community. Members, I think it's important to know that I think the legislation is still important just to clarify for future situations as it relates to what the department can do. I think it's also important to note that we're still trying to get more information from the department. You know, one of the things that we talked about in committee, if you're in southern Minnesota, I mean, we talk a lot about the metro area, but if you're in southern Minnesota, you don't have services everywhere either. But it's a lot easier for you to get from, you know, a Wilmer somewhere versus if you were in Little Falls trying to get somewhere to get services in northern Minnesota, just because of the geography itself and how far everything else. And so it's one of those things that I think that we're going to have to be working on in the next couple of years. It was a missed opportunity, I think, as it relates to a reuse of the building and the facility, especially looking at the amount of beds that we don't have a capacity for children in that particular area. But it's something that we need to be striving for in the next couple of years, and it's one of those things that the department needs to do a better job of looking statewide. Where are our beds? What services really need to go there to make sure that everyone's getting adequate services and not having to drive several hours to do it?
And Resident Walker, this is coming from your division?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And it's...
We had a great time with this, too.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion on the bill? Representative Trimba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is up for you to tell us or what. Is there any chance of it reviving? I mean, I'm in the middle of Wilmer and Brainerd, and I would guess that almost all those kids in my district are ending up in Brainerd, so because they have a better program for those kids.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sella, thank you for that question. And I've been talking with and communicating with Mr. Quistra and Mr. Chesner and in dialogue about asking them to consider reconsidering their decision. We're coming real close to the deadline here. It doesn't look like it's going to be that way, but I'm not giving up hope because For example, one of the things that we were told that Representative Walker's committee was that 60% of the referrals to the CAS program in Brainerd was from the metro area. Now, Mr. Kreutzer has told me that, no, that figure was not accurate. But see, that's my point. The decision was made based on those kind of inaccuracies in those figures. So our kids in central Minnesota, northern Minnesota, are going to have to drive the families, the children. I just got an email today from the parent, Representative Walker, that testified in the committee. And, things are not going well. That family is going to now need to look at, another situation. And now they're going to be either in North Dakota or down in Wilmer versus, as Representative Trump, you talked about, versus Brainerd. So I'm really hopeful that they will reconsider the decision. And I'm going to continue to work with them for services for our children in central and northern Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, the door is really almost pretty closed, and Representative Ward is doing everything possible as it relates to the particular services at this site. It's really it's a done deal. Now it's looking at what other things can be offered around children's mental health in the particular area that can help families that are struggling with their kids. There's a lot of work. One of the things that I don't think the department did a good enough job with coming last year with the mental health reform was really talking about the funding streams for the enterprise initiative, and some of that has to do with the funding mechanism. So if you're a county, are you referring because you don't want, are you not referring because the program needs have changed, or is it more about the cost to the share for the county? And we don't really have a good answer for that. We just have anecdotal stories and differences for counties, but the bottom line, our counties are utilizing other ways to send, especially our kids, different places, including the correctional system. And so the enterprise funding part of it has to be addressed in the next couple of years, too.
All right, seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 2588 be recommended pass as amended to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah. We'll see on the floor with the bill.
Okay.
All right, thanks. The next bill, Representative Tinglestad. I will move that House File 3371 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. And did you want to do your amendments right away?
Why don't I explain a little bit and then we'll put the amendment on. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, I really appreciate being here tonight. I have to tell you that this legislation that we're talking about tonight with the Dobson Records, it's been a long time coming. I think personally, over the last 5 years, I have about 150 hours of work in this legislation. And tonight we have agreement among all the parties, I believe, and I feel like the earth is shaking because it's a huge step forward. It was adoption issues that brought me to the legislature. I had been an adoption volunteer in the 1980s. And worked with Representative Kathleen Blatt on making it possible for independent adoptions in Minnesota. So it's been really an honor for the last 12 years to be working on adoption legislation here at the Capitol. And I have to tell you that there's a real grassroots effort on this legislation here. And there's many people in the audience, so I'm going to have you raise your hands here. Anybody who is an adoptive parent, if you could raise your hand. Great. Okay, next, adoptees. People who are adopted. Great. And then the last part of the triad, first parent. Great. Thank you very much. So I think that's a visual reminder of the coalition that's brought this together. And this has really been a grassroots effort that I've been working on behalf of these people that this is the most important things in their life right now. And it's an honor to really get to this point. Basically, an overview of this legislation, it deals directly with the Department of Health, Department of Vital Records, and I need to mention that in the legislation, it references birth records, and that is kind of the legalese language for birth certificate. So if you can think in terms of what your birth certificate looks like and put it in those terms, birth record is a term that's used by the state registrar over at the Department of Vital Records. So with that, Mr. Chair, if we can put the amendment on, I'll go through the bill and then introduce Mary Martin Mason.
It's the A3 amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
Or I'll change to it.
Right. I will move the A3 amendment and incorporate into that on line 1.23, delete the words adoption advocates, and then after A, insert the word the department. And then on line 1.24, after the word agencies, add and adoption advocates. So the sentence would read, the department shall, in consultation with adoption agencies and adoption advocates, develop, etc. And so I'll just incorporate that language into the amendment. And just to get the bill in the form the author would like it, and I think others would like it, all in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You have several handouts, a recap of the legislation, which I'll go through in a minute, information about what adoption news there's been recently, including reports from the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute about some of the needs in this area, and then also on the yellow sheet was an editorial that appeared in today's Star Tribune from Senator Best and I concerning the needs for this legislation. So real quickly, I'll just go through the recap of the bill. Adult adoptees aged 19 or older who were born in Minnesota shall, upon request, receive a photocopy of the original birth record from the Minnesota Department of Health unless the birth parents previously signed an affidavit of non-disclosure stating that they do not want the information disclosed. And this has been a key piece of the legislation, that we will honor the affidavit of non-disclosure. There's no affidavit of disclosure and non-disclosure on file, the photocopy would be released. The affidavit of disclosure and non-disclosure form issued to birth parents will continue for future adoptions. Adopted adults could receive the birth certificate from the Department of Health if a death certificate of a named person can be found. Adoption advocates will develop and conduct an outreach and educational campaign along with the Department of Health to provide information to those impacted. Health Department will provide a fact sheet, some basic information about counseling and support services available to adopted persons and birth parents, and the department will charge an $18 fee for non-certified copies of the bill, and the birth certificate in the bill becomes effective July 1st, 2009, which was also a compromise piece of this legislation. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Mary Martin Mason, and she could present. We have a couple other people who would like to give a few brief remarks, and then we'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
I'm Mary Martin Mason, and I work, or I serve, or volunteer, I suppose you should say, with the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform.
Please proceed.
Okay. Yes. Chairman Thiessen and committee members, as you look around the room, particularly on this side of the room, no doubt you'll recognize some familiar faces who have returned year after year to pursue legislation that would allow adult adopted persons access to their original birth certificate. We from the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, along with Concerned United Birth Parents, First Nations Orphans Association, and Reuniting Minnesota, are proud to champion House File 3371 hand-in-hand with adoption agencies. This bill is compromise legislation that's based on data that's housed at the Department of Health regarding the documentation of birth mothers' wishes regarding future contact. For birth mothers who previously signed a document saying that they did not want information disclosed, the birth certificate will not be released. And even though this document was introduced in 1982, it will still be available to birth mothers from the past as well as those in the future. For the vast majority of mothers, as revealed by the Department of Health files, adopted adults will get information that research shows enhances their lifelong emotional and medical well-being. Others will testify about the basic innate human need for information about oneself, a need that this group has championed for years. And we who fill this room are a grassroots group. We're passionate and dedicated and poised to conduct a public awareness campaign to reach across the state. And we invite and want to work with adoption agencies in this particular effort. When MCAR was founded, we pledged to stay the course after achieving legislation. We promise to spread the word as we have done with statewide town meetings and with media outreach. We are helped by a constant outpouring in the media that is already reaching Minnesotans. One of the largest advertising agencies in the state just this week gathered data showing that in the last year and a half, over 56 million households across this country have heard about the approach of adoptee access. In Minnesota, 7.5 million households have been exposed to printed publications about this topic. Now, this number reflects only newspaper and magazine and does not include broadcast media. That 7.5 million is easily doubled by a recent barrage on NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, and Minnesota Public Radio. So already birth mothers of every era know that adoption is changing and that they are not the victims of that change. The vast majority of them for whom this bill is designed will welcome that change, but the bill provides a mechanism for the small few who do not sanction this release of information. Between now and July the 1st of 2009, the enactment of this bill, we pledge a statewide public awareness effort that is mirrored in other states that have passed similar legislation. Those states have not needed a fiscal note to spread the word. The results speak for themselves. Oregon celebrates a decade of access this year with no harm done to any party. New Hampshire celebrated a year this past summer, while years of access have accumulated in Tennessee, Alabama, Delaware, and soon to take effect, Maine. The sky has not fallen in those states. And in fact, each health department reports a positive experience. Kansas and Alaska never sealed their birth records, and they too have had no ill effects. So I encourage you to look at this side of the room as a constituent who have labored and longed for all the reform that is represented in House File 3371. Our labors will continue as we work with adopted agencies who, like us, want only the best for adopted adults, for birth parents, and adopted parents. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? Okay.
Mr. Chair, we do have a couple people in the audience.
So, please come down. I have the names of Diane Topness, Gretchen Traylor, Eunice Anderson. Thank you for coming down, and we do have several more bills on the agenda tonight, so if we could...
My name is Diane Topness, and I am reading testimony on behalf of Sandra Sparaza, who has a rare form of cancer, and this testimony is written by Sandy Sparaza. Nearly 44 years ago, as a scared 17-year-old pregnant girl, I signed a document giving my only daughter up for adoption. At the time, I signed a medical history that was sketchy at best, told during a crisis time to a social worker. I'm sorry that I cannot be with you today to testify on behalf of House File 3371. Since I was the fourth female in my family to be diagnosed with cancer, my oncologist suggested that I have a DNA workup to see if there were any mutant genes in our family makeup. Imagine my surprise when it was discovered that I was missing a very important gene in the BRCA compound, a gene that enables the body to identify and fight cancer. Imagine my dismay when I discovered that the mutation I carry is generational, impacting past and future relatives, including my birth daughter, that I relinquished. It saddens me to think how many birth mothers like me placed children for adoption at a time when we had little or no health information to even tell. The preventative measures for women who are at risk for this cancer include increased surveillance during as early as the age of 18 to 21. It also includes preventative removal of the breast as well as preventative removal of the ovaries. Imagine the time bomb that is ticking in adoptive adults who have no idea that unless they take drastic measures, cancer awaits them. I have been the branch coordinator of Concerned United Birth Parents, CUB, for over 33 years. In that capacity, I have the privilege of hearing the personal stories of many hundreds of birth parents and their adopted children. My unique perspective as a birth mother and an advocate for all parties in adoption leads me to support House File 3371, a bill that would give adopted adults access to their original birth certificates while respecting the documented wishes of the few birth parents who have stated they did not wish future contact. This bill does not give the adoptee the right of reunion, but it does allow them the possibility of getting information, and in my case, it could be life-saving information. Some who oppose this bill do so under the misguided thought that allowing adoptees to get their birth information will harm birth mothers who have kept their child a secret. I, though, know better. In the states in which access exists, not one case of harm to birth parents has been documented. No fiscal note has been required in any state to inform birth parents of changes in the law regarding access. Minnesotans have had over 65 million opportunities to view, read, and hear media coverage in the past 2 years on this issue. The treatment of birth mothers of the past and the automatic sealing of the birth certificate of the adopted child, while considered appropriate at the time, was in fact misguided. Today, adoption agencies claim to protect birth mothers from a shameful past under the mistaken idea that secrecy protects them. Secrets about something as momentous as giving birth cannot be harbored by any human being without ongoing grievous harm. House File 3371 is a bill based on data stored at the Health Department. Starting in 1981, birth parents relinquishing a child filed a document stating they wanted or did not want future contact. Overwhelmingly, the preference was for contact. Still, House File 3371 honors the wishes of the 10% of birth parents not wishing contact. I'd like to speak about the small group of birth parents who are naturally apprehensive about opening a door to unaddressed pain of the past. Even so, no birth mother indifference to wrong born out of a secret system should have the right to deny a son or daughter such vital personal information as the record of their birth. If we birth mothers made the decision to carry a child to term, endure the hardship of the adoption process, and love our children enough to place them with a family who could offer what we thought would be a better life, then doesn't it stand to reason that we would love them enough to want them to know the unique story of their birth? Allowing adoptees, birth parents, or siblings separated by adoption to have access to one another is not only a way to answer lifelong questions. More importantly, it may save their lives, as it probably did in the case of my own daughter. I urge you to vote for House File 3371. This was written by Sandra Sapraza of Edina, Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gretchen Traylor. I'm an adoptee, an adoptive parent, and a crisis pregnancy counselor at a pro-life clinic. 4 years ago, I underwent a hip replacement procedure. I nearly bled to death at the time because I and my surgical team were unaware that my birth father's family carried a genetic clotting disorder. My story is just one of many that demonstrate the fact that while lack of privacy doesn't kill, lack of information can, has, and will continue to do so if adoptees are not privy to their own birth information. This revised bill represents compromise on the part of adoption advocacy groups. It is based on recent research by the Minnesota Department of Health that shows that over 90% of birth parents are open to at least some contact with the adult child they relinquish. In this revised bill, even in light of the danger to a minority of adopted persons, birth parents would still have the right to attach an affidavit of non-disclosure to their relinquished offspring's birth record, and a small minority may choose to do so. On the positive side, birth parents who may have languished for many years under the umbrella of shame, guilt, and worry about their relinquished children would now know that they may attach an affidavit of disclosure to facilitate contact with their adult child. They will also be able to change, add, or remove an affidavit at any time. How will older birth parents know that these options are available to them? As recently stated by both Mary and Sandy, there have been many, many millions of media hits available to Minnesotans and nationwide. This has been a national and local news currently and constantly, and will continue to be because it draws intense media interest. In addition, I would mention that movies such as Juno, out this summer, and Reader's Digest, a very well-read magazine, both have carried pieces about this issue recently. No state that has enacted acts of legislation has needed a fiscal note in order to publicize access information due to this intense media interest. Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform stands prepared to work with other adoption advocacy groups and agencies to provide the maximum public awareness possible. We will target public awareness campaigns toward communities where senior citizens live and can be reached. Our goal will be to make access to affidavit information and availability as complete and simple as possible. It is our desire and intent to alert all birth parents that the affidavit options exist in order to allow those who still wish to maintain privacy to do so, the 10%, while also allowing those who do wish to know about their adult children to do so as well, the 90%. The bill will not be effective until July 1st, 2009, in order to allow time for a publicity campaign to be effective. Have there been any recorded instances in states with access to records where birth parents have had to prosecute adoptees for violations of privacy? Absolutely not. I refer to statistics gathered by the Alan Guttmacher Institute. Life in these states have gone on normally. Adoptees do not have a right to reunion, and many are not looking for reunion. They do have a right to potentially life-saving information not only for themselves, but for their children and grandchildren as well. Will providing adopted adults access to their original birth records cause a rise in abortions or a decrease in adoptions? Again, no. State-by-state records collected by the Guttmacher Institute indicate just the opposite. In states with access, the abortion rate is lower and the adoption rate is higher than in states without access. For example, in Oregon, a state which granted access in 1998, the adoption rate is 3.1%. In Alaska, a state in which original birth records were never closed to the adoptee, this is the nation's highest adoption rate at 3.9%. Minnesota's adoption rate, in comparison, is 2.6%. My own experience as a crisis pregnancy counselor at Birthright bears this out. Women have not approached me once about adoption with fears of being found later in life. Instead, they come and talk to me about adoption with fears that they will lose contact with this child forever. Will adoptees be better able to gather accurate, complete, and ongoing medical information for themselves than if they use an intermediary? Absolutely. It is prohibitively costly and time-consuming to use the present intermediary system, and obviously out of the question for most, if not all, adoptees to do so yearly, as recommended by the Surgeon General of the U.S., or even every 5 years. In my own case, it was the year after an intermediary contacted my birth mother that she developed breast cancer. This then did not include contact with my father's family, as that would have required a second fee and more waiting. This, of course, would have been the source of information about the clotting disorder, which nearly took my life. 60 years ago, people much like yourselves sat where you are sitting now and passed the current law, closing my records even to me, the adoptee, in an attempt to protect me from the stigma of bastardy. Contrary to its intent, this law has never protected me. You now have the opportunity to bring this law up to current standards and still offer non-disclosure to those wishing it. Please vote yes on House Bill 3371. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Keeson. I just have a question about the fee. I had some work with this back with Catholic Charities many years ago, and then I was curious about what the fee is. Is it like $700 or that comes to mind? And that, you know,
I'm not sure exactly what they would tell you today.
Mm-hmm.
As of the last couple years, the cap for me as a part-time special education teacher would have been $650.
Okay.
It has varied based on income, and they do require a copy of your income tax. So it's a sliding scale.
And
Did we do some work on that, Representative Tinglester? Did we talk about lowering that fee? Is there any work in that area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as far as I know, that was adjusted maybe 15 years ago on the sliding fee scale, so there hasn't really been any questions about that. But with this process, you know, the adoption agencies will be involved in doing some counseling and other things, and I know we have somebody on the list here coming up that could probably give more details on that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, Ms. Anderson.
My name is Eunice Anderson, and I'm an adopted mother. I live in Burnsville, Minnesota. I'm an adopted mother of three now adult children and a member of MCAR. Adoption is a triad. You just heard from the adoptee and the birth mother. And now you need to hear from the third part of the triad, the adoptive parent. My testimony will tell you that passing House File 3371 is the right thing to do and why. My story briefly concerns mothering. I thought I knew how to be a good mother. I had a good upbringing, Lutheran farming community, loving parents, siblings. So when time came to parent my children, I knew I could do that, no problem. But there was a big problem, secrecy problem. The adoption agency assured us that our parenting would make our 3-5-week-old babies into adults just like we were. We did not need any background information, they said. Today we know that keeping birth information a secret has proven to be fraught with serious physical and mental consequences for all the members of the triad. My mother was going fairly well until they were teenagers, and then we one child had a DWI and another attempted suicide. I knew then that my mothering needed help, and that help might need to come from my children's birth family. Because contact with the children's birth family was not legally possible, the adoption agency wrote down all our non-identifying information from their files. Each child carried that 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that with that information to school. They showed their teachers. They showed their friends. Watching all this, I thought, if that sheet of paper telling about their birth family does so much for them, what would finding the real birth family do? And if you'll notice, I say birth family, not birth mother. When you find them, it's the birth family that's important. I promised to help them search someday. Fast forward to when my children were in their 30s and my son had his master's degree in fine art, but he said he needed one more piece of information. So he called the adoption agency and asked for his birth mother's name. The stark reply was, "You have no right to do that." As I picked up our badly damaged telephone from the floor, I knew it was time to keep my promise to my adult son, who had just been told he was not capable of knowing the truth of his beginning. In 10 years, we searched with little bits of information, and all three birth families wanted a reunion. But the biggest reward I got was hearing my children say, "Now I can handle life." I had treated them as adults. Their birth families treated them as adults, but the law did not. Now I work with MCAR as a mother advocating the rights for all of adult adoptees. And by the way, I work at the University of Minnesota Bookstore, where I find a lot of adoptees. Who still cannot access their birth information. And you've heard how this bill is a compromise on our part, and we will work to get the information out. So I'll kind of skip over that. And that Minnesota's not alone. 8 states have passed this law. And I'll end it with, what I did for my children was the right thing to do. What I did for their birth families was the right thing to do. What I did for my mothering was the right thing to do. I'm here this evening to ask you to do the right thing this year. House File 3371 would allow adopted adults from the same era that my children were adopted to have their birth information. Please do the right thing.
Thank you. Any questions, Thomas? Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Tingleston and our guests. I just have a bit of caution in how the publicity goes out on this, because I think Minnesota is recognized nationally as being a place where there are more international adoptions than the national average. And I think sensitivity needs to be shown not only for birth mothers who weren't offered prior to 1982 the opportunity to sign an affidavit of non-disclosure, so that there's a group that feels they have a different deal with the state that will be changing now. But I think particularly for the many, many young children of all ages and adults who were internationally adopted, for whom this is not going to offer a solution if this is presented in the media as a really life-fulfilling, life-changing experience that fills a hole in their life. It may, if not handled sensitively, help people for whom that isn't an option. And so I just would say to all, we need to be really careful as we roll this out.
Mrs. Kilka? Welcome to the committee.
My name is Kathy Kukalka. I am the Vice President of Advancement at Children's Home Society and Family Services. Children's Home Society and Family Services has always supported the right of both adopted persons and birth parents to request information and contact. The agency was founded in 1889 to find home for the children arriving in St. Paul on orphan trains. Over nearly 120 years, our services have evolved to meet the changing needs of children and families. Today, Children's Home Society and Family Services is a strong advocate for open adoption and supports open records for adoptions now and in the future. For more than 15 years, Children's Home Society has been a vocal opponent of any legislation to open birth records when a birth parent had requested they kept confidential. Our position was based on the belief that the promise we made of confidentiality to our clients is fundamental to the relationship we have with them. House File 3371, as amended, makes significant changes to earlier versions of open adoption legislation that we opposed. The agency recognizes and respects the compromises made by adoption advocates that are reflected in this language. The most crucial in the view of Children's Home Society is that the current system, which allows birth parents to file affidavits of non-disclosure, will continue and that these affidavits will be respected. Three other provisions in the amendment are very important to Children's Home Society and to the birth parents who made an adoption plan before the current system became law, and who asked that their information not be released to their child when the child was adopted. The first provision that is very important is that the effective date is delayed, which would allow more time for the Department of Health, adoption agencies, and advocates to reach out to people affected by the law to educate them about their options. Another very important aspect of the amendment to us is that the Department of Health is responsible for conducting the education and outreach program using its staff and resources in consultation with agencies and advocates. With all due respect, I don't think that Juno and the Reader's Digest are reliable sources of information for people who are faced with potentially life-changing experiences. At this point, when we are doing searches and contacting birth mothers on behalf of people whose records are closed, 20% of those birth mothers request that there be no contact. It's not an inconsiderable number. They have a number of very personal reasons for not wanting that contact, and I think that they have to be respected as part of the triad. The information about post-adoption services for adopted adults and birth parents referenced in the amendment will be made available by the department. It's our understanding that this information will be given to adopted adults who request birth records under this legislation. It has been our experience that professional services, including the use of an intermediary, make the initial contact much more successful and result in a more positive outcome for both the adopted adult and the birth mother or father. Out of respect for the birth parents who asked for and were promised privacy under the old system, Children's Home Society and Family Services cannot support this legislation. However, based on our experience with open adoption, recognizing the changes in values and attitudes that have occurred in our society since 1945, when birth records were sealed for adopted people,
and recognizing the compromise made by the authors and adoption advocates in respecting and continuing the use of affidavits of non-disclosure, Children's Home Society and Family Services will not oppose House File 3371 as amended.
Thank you. Questions, members? Okay, thank you. Terry Berner? Hi. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and Representatives. My name is Terry Bernard. I get the impression that this bill is somewhat of a done deal, and I'm actually here in opposition, and I appreciate you hearing my voice. I'm 37 years old, and I was adopted as a toddler. I oppose House File 3371 as it's currently written. My concern is not so much about the current and modern adoptions. It's more, in this open culture, it's more about those adoptions that took place decades ago, such as mine. About a year ago, after much vacillation, I finally contacted St. Louis County and paid the $250 fee to start my search for my birth mother. Last July, my caseworker found her. I have not spoken to her. I don't know her name. I don't know where she lives. Based on what I've been told by my caseworker, who's acting as the intermediary, I'm not sure whether my birth mother will ever be ready for contact. My cautious outreach seems to have stirred up unwanted and uncomfortable feelings. If I would have shown up on her doorstep, I believe she would have been devastated. If she had done the same to me 5 years ago, let alone at age 19, my world would have been turned upside down. I embarked on my search to learn about my heritage and to uncover my medical background. Having direct access to my birth certificate would not have given me these answers. They are only accessible by asking my birth parents and only if that information is forthcoming from those people. In my case, my birth father is not even mentioned on my birth certificate, according to my caseworker. The proponents of this bill seem to focus on the positive and best case scenarios. While some of my adoptive friends have experienced wonderful connections with their birth family, others are deeply hurt. Birth parents and adopted children who want to connect should be able to make that choice freely. Using an intermediary like I am doing ensures a level of anonymity and protection so that parties can agree on whether they, on when or how or if they want to connect. As this proposal stands, parties have to actively opt out of being contacted by formally submitting an affidavit of non-disclosure. For a birth mother who is emotionally buried what may have been an incredibly painful or difficult choice, this is requiring an unreasonable act. Advocacy groups state that most birth parents welcome contact, but I don't know how we can quantify the number who have stated that there's no harm done, because these are all silent voices. This bill does not adequately protect those parties who would feel threatened or hurt by unwanted contact. Even if they are in the minority, this bill has deep emotional implications to birth parents that shouldn't be dismissed. If this bill is to move forward, it should at least be modified from an opt-out to an opt-in approach. Birth parents or adoptees who want to connect can file an affidavit of disclosure or whatever documentation or registration is feasible. Those that don't can still be assured, even through no action, that their privacy and wishes are not jeopardized. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Golden, or Dr. Golden wants to testify, no, but is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify on the bill? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Penelope Needham. I'm an adopted person. I'm a member of the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform. I have taught public school in Minnesota for the past 4 decades nearly, and I also lead support groups for adoptive adolescents.
As a teacher, I understand the sincerity and importance of a child's question, where did I come from? I also understand the importance of being truthful and forthcoming with the answers. The state of Minnesota is responsible for recording births. Birth records contain names, dates, times, and places. They are also called vital statistics. It is important and vital to record all people's births, and especially vital for the person who was born. Especially because, of course, they were not able to record it themselves. People who are not adopted sometimes don't understand how important it is to have their own original birth information or think adoptees already have it. Actually, adoptees have an altered birth certificate which was created at the time of their adoption. Their original names are changed, and often there are omissions of original facts like places and times. House File 3371 would allow adult adoptees in Minnesota to have their own original birth record and know their own truth. These are especially important to those of us who are adopted, and there are benefits to telling the truth. You no longer have to guard the secrets. You can save resources. Secret keeping can be expensive and involve personnel, money, and time. The secret keepers can be freed for other activities. The anger and frustration of those who are kept from the secret can be dispelled. The benefits for the adopted person are: the adoptee has their own truth, the facts of their birth. The adoptee can know, where did I come from, and go on developmentally to who am I. The adopted person has a resource for finding their own medical, social, and cultural histories, which can impact their health, their life, and the lives of their progeny. The adopted person has a resource for possible family reconnection. Now, you just heard testimony from someone who didn't have the reunion that they envisioned, but it does allow knowing who you are. There are no guarantees after you've been recorded and gotten your certificate as to what kind of relationships you'll have in your life, but I believe that all adoptees need the basic information of who they are. Airing and openness are natural healers. Healing and forgiveness are collateral gifts for all involved parties who are affected by the closing and the reopening of these records. I am committed, along with other NCAR members, to support the efforts in the process of healing and forgiveness. Joining with us are other adoption professionals, educators like myself, social workers, and therapists. Concerned United Birth Parents is both a national organization and a Minnesota organization. If you've ever been to one of their meetings, it's standing room only in the state of Minnesota, in our city. Reuniting Minnesota helps adoptees and birth parents reconnect. The American Adoption Congress, a national organization supporting adoption, whose members include adoptees, birth parents, adoptive parents, and adoption professionals, also can help. As a grassroots group, we've been working for nearly 20 years, along with other adoptees, birth parents, adoptive parents, and professionals, trying to get Minnesota to change the law to allow adoptees to have their own birth certificates. It's been very frustrating, but now it seems like things are about to change. The World Child Welfare League supports the opening of adoption records. The Evan B. Donaldson Institute research paper, published in November of 2007, supports the release of records, and also says it's negative consequences to the adoptee if you don't release the records. In addition, Alaska and Kansas, where birth records were never closed, the six additional U.S. states who have opened them find that it's positive. I sincerely hope that you have the courage to open adoption records to adoptees, and be among the states who no longer do harm and provide full and truthful vital statistics to the people for whom they are so vital. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Golden. Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am with the Minnesota Department of Health. I am the Director of Health Policy. And one of my responsibilities at the department is to oversee the vital records area, the birth and death records that are there. We recognize this is a very emotional issue on both sides, and I am not here to take a position on either side as to what the access to the birth records should be.
whatever it is, I am concerned about making sure that we can implement that, and we will implement that according to the law as we do today. What I am just wanting to make sure that there isn't some confusion about is actually Subdivision 5. I would like to make sure that the committee understands what the department does and doesn't do so that we aren't having been promised to do something that we don't do or can't do, as the case might be. What we do is, much like the last witness said, we actually record birth and death officially for the state. In doing that, we try to record it accurately. We make a special effort to maintain and protect the data. These are identity documents. They are as sensitive as driver's license or any other identity document. Our first focus is on security. And then we work with our partners. It might be the Social Security Administration. It might be public safety for driver's license, medical assistance. In doing that, the types of organizations that we work with are the local registers, the hospitals, the coroners, medical examiners, funeral directors, and then citizens who are trying to get their birth or death records. We don't generally work with any of the adoption agencies. That is not our role as a state agency. So if we are being asked to do those things, those aren't natural constituencies for us. I wanted to just be clear about that. In number five, I'm sorry, I stepped into the room right as the amendment went on. It's my understanding that the department shall provide outreach and education to adopted persons and birth parents. I just wanted to say, if it's within the existing plan and budget, as of today, we don't have a plan nor a budget for that. Those aren't constituencies other than birth parents at a hospital who are giving birth that we currently work with. If it's new people, we could certainly do that with birth parents through a hospital. If it's existing adoptees and birth parents who might have given up an adoption previously, I guess my concern would be I have no idea how to contact either of those two groups of people. I would just point out that there is a process today associated with gaining access to an original birth record. It's in Chapter 259. It is part of the Department of Human Services. When we get a request for an original birth record today, we send it over to the Department of Human Services. And it takes them, they have under statute, 6 months to try to find the person. So I just want to be clear that I don't know of any way that the department would actually be able to contact existing adopted persons and birth parents. The other small comment is in Subdivision 5, Paragraph C, where the department shall provide information about counseling and support services. This is in the vital records section. I assume that would be the responsibility of vital records. I have to say we don't have any idea what would be the appropriate information to provide to those people with regard to counseling, with regard to support services. I'm sure there are people who do know who they should talk to, what they might need to know in moving forward, and why that's important. But in passing the people who record birth and death, that just isn't something that has been traditionally in our scope, and you may not get as positive a result assigning that responsibility to us as you might hope. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To Mr. Golden's concerns, and we've been trading phone calls between DHS and MDH all week on this legislation here, like a couple weeks actually. I'm not sure if he had the most up-to-date version of the amendment on line 2.3, which the department shall provide a fact sheet. And we're basically looking at an 8.5 by 11 list of adoption agencies or other support services, and the advocates and the agencies would be willing to work together to put that list. So I'm thinking photocopying expenses. So that's the extent of that. In regards to Subdivision 5 about the outreach, I know that this bill is going to Representative Clark's committee where we'll deal with that in more detail. With this legislation, there are several repealers, which actually saves the state money, So in talking to the department people, we're looking at within existing resources, because they won't have to do it the old way, that they would be able to do some outreach. And I understand, Mr. Golden in a box here tonight, as we're talking about MDH instead of DHS, but this was a last-minute amendment that came up right before we walked into committee.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't know if there are any savings. All I can say from our standpoint, there would not be savings at MDH. And the reason is MDH is not the state agency that conducts the search. That is in Chapter 259.89. It is the Department of Human Services. I have not spoke with them as to whether or not they would have savings. Perhaps Representative Singelstad has. Again, our role and responsibility is to protect and only release the data according to the instructions. There's very little cost for us. The statute just says if we get this request, within 5 days, send it to the Department of Human Services. So any cost associated with health, the Department of Health for this, would not be offset by savings. They may be at DHS, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, and the bill is going to the Finance Committee, and so I think we can work out this cross-agency issue. Or at least attempt to do that. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tingle said just one more thing for you to think about as this evolves. Typically when things go through family court, there's a report back cycle, and I'm kind of struck by the witness who said that 20% of the birth parents that they contact don't want connection, and the adoptee who said she was advised it might not be in the best interest of her birth mother. And so I'm wondering if at a minimum we might want to have, if they go through this process, something that they report back in a year later, did they make the connection, was it, just getting some feedback of how it's working might be a pretty simple sort of thing. And I think it's a real typical thing of, through almost anything in family court, there's some loop back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I appreciate that input. That's certainly something that we'll look into. And, certainly involving the adoption agencies as an intermediary and using them with their counseling services is a key component to this as well. But we can follow up on that. Thank you.
Further discussion, members? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3371 be recommended to pass as amended to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, myself and our group were very much indebted to you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
That's been received and welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3955 that it be recommended pass and refer to the general register. And
We have to finance.
We won't after this.
But okay. All right.
It's
continue.
It's going to the general register, right, Kat?
Is it going to the general register?
I'm sorry.
Finance.
Finance.
Oh, okay. All right, to finance.
Please continue.
And I'd like to put the DE one on, if I could.
Members have the DE one amendment.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And this just to get the bill in the order, it kind of fixes up some technical stuff. And so if we could just put that on, that would be great.
Okay, guys. To the amendment, all in favor, please do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, amendment has been adopted.
Okay, and then I'd also like to add the A1 amendment, which is actually an amendment to the DE1 amendment, so it just corrects some things in the DE1 amendment.
All in favor of the amendment, the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Amended.
Members, this is this legislation is an idea brought forward by a number of groups who are involved in issues related to aging and older Minnesotans. And really the essential idea of what we're trying to do here is we have several different pots and streams of money that flow into services for older adults, whether it's nursing homes or community-based services, home-based services. And what we're trying to do here on a very small scale is segregate a piece of each of those funds, just a small percentage of each of those funds, into a different kind of grant, which is a community consortium could be formed and apply for the grants and actually draw down a percentage of those funds to build so that we can access kind of all these different streams of funding by one group, so we can combine our efforts, streamline efforts, and make a much broader effort at improving older adult services in Minnesota. It really made a lot of sense to me. It makes a lot of sense to me that we would actually start trying to focus disparate streams of income into one pot so that people can do comprehensive planning in their communities about how we're going to deal with the age wave that's coming. And that's the essence of it. I would like to have some testifiers come up and talk in more detail about the bill.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dan Lind with Presbyterian Homes and Services. And tonight, representing care providers and MHHA through the Imperative and the provider community. Reform and transformation in older adult services is happening throughout this state at a fairly remarkable rate. And some of the benchmarks include the number of care center beds decreasing rather significantly, the care center beds that are there being used for short-term and transitional care, a dramatic increase in home and community-based services supported by technology and implemented by a number of different kinds of provider groups. A variety of housing and services and assisted living and other work is being implemented as well. And some of the players that are involved with this transformation are somewhat surprising. They include secondary education, and they include high schools, they include counties and HRAs, they include foundations and communitarians, they include community service groups, informal and formal. And some of the things that are happening are fairly interesting. We're seeing rural regionalization of healthcare services in the same way that not every community could have its own hospital and could have its own school. Now that sort of thing is affecting older adult services. And so communities are attempting to work together and providers are attempting to work together to aggregate services so that a better, more streamlined, and more thorough type of service can be made available to older adults in the state. Some of the interesting models that we've seen include aggregating acute care with older adult service settings, home-delivered meals coming out of sites, county library branches, YMCA partnerships, transportation systems, senior centers, volunteer delivery of meals, and capturing information upstream to affect the way services are coordinated and provided. Continuing education from both colleges and high schools, active on-site where older adults are also present, and then wellness centers to help reduce falls and strengthen and integrate people in the community. Interestingly enough, one of the barriers, there are several we could talk about. One that's significant is the impact of critical access hospitals, because that is an example. A hospital becomes critical access, which is a good thing. But some of the issues that arise out of that are disincentives to stay involved with necessary older adult services because of how the funding mechanisms work. And we have noted in other parts of the world dramatic changes in transformation of older adult services that are ahead of this country, even though Minnesota in some ways is a leader here. Parts of Europe, parts of the common market there, parts of Pacific Rim countries, and of course in relative age they are older. They are where we will be 10 and 12 years from now. And so the intent of this legislation, which is not costly to the state, is to develop some community pilots that will address some of these issues in a more proactive way and to, through these pilot incentives, encourage different players in the community that are now involved some way or another or affected by how older adult services are provided to come to the table and to work together. And we know their interest in both rural and metro settings, and we think that some significant pilots that successfully implemented can be of use to policymakers to kind of test to see what works and what doesn't and how savings can be achieved and how we can take better care of and meet the needs of older adults in our communities.
Thank you. Thank you. We have questions for the witness. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either Representative Thiessen or Representative Fire, first of all, I really appreciate this. I think this is we've got to be doing this, especially in rural areas. I serve on our Minnesota Rural Health Advisory Committee. We've talked a lot about how we make this happen in rural areas, and it seems to me this kind of consortium approach and grants to help make it happen are a great idea. We've also heard stories of nonprofit organizations, volunteer groups, faith-based organizations coming together to try to keep older adults healthy and living in their own homes in rural communities. How are they integrated into this approach? Would they be part of these consortiums as well? I'm thinking that, and this isn't an under radar thing or trying to slip it a Mickey, but faith-based organizations are really critical in some of these areas, and I think they need to be part of these consortiums.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question. They are definitely included, and we would see them as being some of the leaders in taking steps along with others, too. We fall into that camp ourselves, and we've seen tremendous support from communitarians and foundations and others who have an interest in what the future landscape of the state is in rural areas. And it doesn't take long to get older adult services real near the top of that list. And so to answer your question, we would envision them being involved in a very significant and meaningful way.
And just to clarify, and some of the grants that we're combining here, they would go to those organizations that are specifically named and under current law.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking for clarification. I'm not certain I understand the entire way this works, and it sounds like a good idea, but I'm concerned about Subdivision 3. Which it requires. It requires all the commissioners to give priority to these consortiums, and I guess I'm a little concerned with how that would relate to other grants from other communities that might warrant based on merit or need, and you're going to give priority to a community that might have a better ability to have a consortium, and I'm just wondering how you're going to balance true merit and true need within the community when you've got this kind of language in there.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Cullen. Thank you. My name is Patty Cullen with Care Providers of Minnesota, and I've worked with the variety of state agency and the technical language in putting this together. Subdivision 3 talks about priorities within the provision of older adult service grants that they would already do. So, for example, the Department of Transportation has two pots of money that they have available that could be used in part of the response to the RFP from this consortium. One of their pots of money provides for buses and vans for the disabled and elderly to use in a community. So when they're looking at providing these kinds of grants anyway for older adult services, all we're saying is that they should look to the consortiums, if these consortiums have as part of their plan within the RFP, that they're going to meet the community needs. And one of the needs is a gap in transportation services. That's how the connection is there. It's kind of a soft suggestion that these agencies look at consortiums if within these consortiums that's one of the services they have deemed that they're going to do. And the same thing, Housing Finance Agency helps us structure the language for their consideration under Subdivision 3 as well. So we worked with the various agencies to get their feedback on how would they like the language structure to help guide them. So I don't think it's really a competition. The idea here is that through the RFP process, these consortiums would be selected based on either their unique nature, the unmet needs. I mean, there's a variety of things that would be considered. Background information that you don't have behind here is we've listed out some of the possible outcomes that we would like to see within these consortiums that would be built into the RFP. We didn't want to put too much detail in the law because we do want the process to weave its way through.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think, this members of this committee know that I have a bill on county-based purchasing that we spent some time on the other night, and this is something that Olmsted County and four other counties around Olmsted want to get up and running, and it's already going in 27 counties in the state. And when I look at this, I think this is a really intriguing idea, and it reminds me in some ways of county-based purchasing. And in that, this potential coordination, kind of a coordination of care idea. I'm looking at this, and this, frankly, is the first time I've seen this. So, you know, if my question isn't entirely well-formed, excuse me for that, but I'm just kind of looking at this. Healthcare and social service providers and county agencies and health plan companies. I mean, I guess I want to know how would this work or could this work in counties that have county-based purchasing? And, what's the intersection between the two ideas? I guess that's what I want to know. Anyone can speak to that.
I would say that I don't think it would be preferential one way or another. I think that the point you make about what county-based purchasing is aiming at is there's similarities in purpose, I guess, between trying to combine social services and healthcare and a variety of things. But the thing I would say, this is aimed at first older adults as opposed to everybody, and it's not necessarily aimed at people that are in public programs. This would be planning for kind of a community wide approach to this, but I don't think it would exclude certainly any area that has county-based purchasing instead of a health plan, because it would be that the consortium could consist of these various parts, and it would be up to the community to decide who would be members of the consortium. You know, they would come together, the nonprofits, the public agencies, and the providers, you know, et cetera. I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Yeah, it does. It does get at it. It's a different, right, this is just older adults. It's not necessarily public programs, although I presume that a lot of the seniors who might be involved could be on public programs. But, you know, I think we're all kind of trying to get to the same ideas here, it seems, just by slightly different methods. You know, the idea that we tend to do things in different silos and that we could get better results if we broke down those silos to some degree.
Madam Chair, if I might respond to that, one potential example would be a partnership that we're involved with, Presbyterian Homes, with Cuyuna Regional Medical Center in Crosby, Minnesota. And in that community, we in the hospital are building Heartwood, which is a mini continuum of care with a center for case-like MSHL that we hope to integrate transportation systems, and we're close to a county line, so you've got county purchasing from two different counties that affect people just because they're a mile or two apart. And we have HRAs who own 202 projects, and we have the hospital has physician coverage in certain areas but not to another area, even though home care doesn't follow it quite the same way. I'm not saying this would be an ideal model, but this is just an example of what we might be talking about. So the question would be, in that specific region, how can we make a difference that goes past some of the boundaries that counties have because of how they've got their system set up, that integrate some of the federal programs with capitated AAPCC funding that goes to HMOs and that type of thing, and those that are on direct Medicare, and start to say what services are available to help a person live at home or have their situation optimized. That would be an example, in my mind, of the kind of pilot that might come out of a program like this.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
No. Representative Loeffler has a question, I think.
I'm sorry. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, I'm just trying to get my hand around the consortium language is kind of vague, and the older Americans, I don't know if we're targeting people at a particular age or anyone over 50. I'm not quite sure how it relates to, like, MSO and AC and EW and the current sort of service system. I don't know if the target population, if you could just help me a little bit more. Is this the people who are younger than that and aren't yet in need of those kind of levels of services? Is it more to serve a whole community, which include people who are above that economic scale? I'm just trying to get my hands around.
Well,
I'll services. I understand kind of the concept of all these different organizations coming together.
I'll answer briefly, and then maybe the other witnesses can. I think one way to get at your question is where the money is being drawn from. And so it's 10% of moratorium exception dollars that we have in the state. So that's nursing home dollars. And there's another program we have for the alternative payment incentives for nursing homes. Okay, so that's another stream. And these grants would have to, you know, in some sense, be consistent with those things. And then we have, in other areas of law, grants to private and public nonprofits in several areas that are to provide older adult services. So whether it's transportation, caregiver support and respite, living at home block, nurse stuff. So those are the streams of money that we're talking about, and the consortium would come up with a proposal that would be able to integrate all those different streams consistent with their purposes, but in one proposal. Instead of what we would have today is one community may be able to get the caregiver and respite stuff. Some other community would get stuff that helps the nursing home, and there's no continuum built around that. But I don't know if Ms. Collins has more to...
Ms. Collins.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the intention is the over 65 population. We're not, however, in this proposal taking away from services they would otherwise be qualified to receive. So if someone currently is eligible for LD and receiving EW services, alternative care grant services, they could still do that under this proposal. The intention here is that we're going to bridge the silos and provide gaps and provide a bridge between the gaps and services identified by the county. And a more simplistic explanation, a smaller scale one, Dan always thinks a lot bigger than I do, I think smaller, is let's say it was determined in a community that for all the folks that are in their homes right now, transportation is still the top issue. It was identified by the gaps now. County-based purchasing may actually, or MSHO, or whatever in terms of the services, may pay for a ride, but there's no van. And there's no service to try to buy the van and orchestrate the coordination of transportation services. So one of the components of this community consortium could be, we're going to buy a van using some funds that we've put together in this pool, and we're going to orchestrate rides that make some sense for this community. Everyone involved will still get the services they would have otherwise gotten under EW or alternative care grant program, but this added benefit is now they have a mechanism to get to their appointments.
And, Madam Chair, I think, Representative Loeffler, if you look at lines 2.4 and 2.5, 2.4 and 2.5, you know, it will be, they're tying it into the gaps analysis and that's currently being done under statute as well. So it's trying to tie all the pieces to work that's already being currently done.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, the other question that I had was, we're granting them authority to approve, or the commissioners, to use this process to approve moratorium exception projects, which is always been something that I think we've always weighed. I don't know that we've delegated that in the past. And so I'm just...
We for long-term care, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's different than the hospital moratorium exception. There's actually a process we set up in law where the commissioner does have discretion to grant those. I don't know if that's what you're...
Oh.
It doesn't come back to the legislature.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, I just remember, maybe it's for my first term, I just remember a lot of bills with exceptions to the nursing home moratorium, but you're saying we've taken that out of this process.
Well,
no?
You can, this is not that, you can explain it maybe if you want. There's two different things.
The legislature allocates the fund of money for the moratorium exception process for facility renovations, replacements for nursing facilities itself. The bills that you all see are outside of that process because they didn't want to go through that process. So there are exceptions to the moratorium bills you'll see, but there's also a process that is funded by the legislature, and that's the reference that we put in the language.
Thank you. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question on page 2, subdivision 5. The Commissioner of Health may waive applicable state laws and rules on a time-limited basis. Could you give me an example of what rule or law we may just decide to, you know, and is this done in other areas? Have we seen this language before?
Thank you. Very good question, Madam Chair, Representative. One of the examples that I would give on this, and sometimes it helps to put an example, is in a rural community, one of the hurdles that has been identified right now to keeping people in their homes is the restriction on needing to have a Medicare-certified home care agency to provide certain services. If you can't find enough hours of RN, but you have LPN and you have something else, so you still can't do it, so these people are now moved into a nursing home. And in talking with Darcy Minor at the Department of Health and asking what she'd like to see, because she's part of the review panel for these consortiums, in response to the RFP, they would have to put in there, this is what we think we need for this community. We know we don't have enough RNs to cover all of this, but what we'd like to do is keep people at home and have a block nurse program that has a consult over here, but not have a Medicare-certified home care agency, because that certification process is pretty time-consuming and expensive. That would be a simple example.
And as part of the reporting, you would also identify larger state policies, I think, that would get in the way of these project goals if we were to take it more generally. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Lawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's in this bill, and I've seen it in other bills, the subdivision 4 on line 2.27, which is directing the Commissioner of Human Services to request a federal waiver. And I chafe always at the federal restrictions and love looking for waivers, but it's been very clear that the current rules right now and in Washington are the price of any waiver is a freezing or a give back of MA funds. They really want you to agree to a cap, and many issues that I've even worked on in partnership with DHS where they'd love to have a waiver, they just said that the price of getting one is too great. And so I would really encourage in this bill and in others that we have some flexibility so that if the commissioner runs into that kind of a Sophie's choice, that they actually have still a choice, because that is unfortunately the current climate in Washington.
Okay, I think the point well taken. I'm not sure what else to do with that right now.
All right, and Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I have a A2 amendment that should be in front of you. It was passed out. There was an earlier version in your packet, but we're doing the one that was passed out tonight. It's an amendment to the delete all that's before us, the DE1. And this does not change any of the content of what's been discussed up now regarding this bill. This is just an add-on at the front of this bill on a kind of a almost a technical correction, but a correction to a problem that's occurred in the last couple of years with some of our disability waiver programs. What this bill does, a couple of years ago, the Health and Human Services chopped off coverage out of their provider manual for physical activities and exercise for our disabled community to be included under their waivers. And what this bill does, what this amendment does, is it includes language that allows physical activities and exercise to improve the individual's functioning to be included in the individual service plan as an allowed expense for home and community-based waivers. The text in the two main paragraphs, sub 4E and sub 2.2 before you, lines 1.6 and 1.17, are essentially the same. Just the top paragraph refers to the developmental disability waiver,
The bottom paragraph refers to the other three key waivers that this is applied to, which are the CAC, CADI, and TBI waivers. That's the traumatic brain injury, the community alternative alternatives for disabled individuals, and community alternatives for children waivers. So very essentially, I'm putting this forward because with this change, I had constituents in my community who no longer could go to the Courage Center, for example, to do their swimming or their supported exercises. And most folks need accessible equipment. They need special equipment appropriate for them, special kinds of swimming pool structures and in and out, those kinds of things. This puts it back in to be allowed and in a cost-neutral way because it will be included within the that the cost will not increase the person's authorized annual budget amount. So we're intending for this to be cost neutral, change back to allowing this within those four waivers. So that's what this is. And I just would ask for your support for this amendment so this could be for us this session. After we're facing other tough choices this session, but in fact, if we can allow them to do this health, exercise and activities that will lower our costs for caring, providing services for these folks in the long term, that we can do this session by allowing this back in a cost-neutral fashion. Any questions on the amendment?
I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Let's adopt the amendment, the A2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Say aye. Aye. It's been adopted. Representative Thiessen to the bill.
Well, thank you for all the questions, and I think, you know, this is a different way of thinking about these things, and, you know, we can work with it as we proceed forward, but I do think it makes sense. I was surprised at seeing the various streams that are independently granted and brings at least trying out and seeing if we can bring some more uniformity to that, I think is a good idea. And it's only three projects to start out with, so it's not a huge amount of money, but I think it's a good experiment for us to try, and it's cost neutral. So.
Thank you. Representative Houston renews his House File 3955 to be passed as amended to the Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
Thank you, members.
The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Now, it's been a long night for me.
Okay, Representative Fritz, before us is House File 3400. Representative Fritz will move her own bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 3400 to be...
The Committee on Finance.
To Finance, yes.
And I believe, are these amendments yours, or...
We have two amendments.
Why don't you move those in the shape that you want, and then we will take the bill with the amendments on it.
All right, we could start with the A1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Fritz moves A1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment adopted. And then I believe the A3 is yours as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the A3 amendment.
Okay, Representative Fritz moves A3. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment adopted. Go ahead, Representative Fritz.
Thank you.
Explain your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for hearing House File 3400 this evening. This bill has been a long time coming. Again, we are back. I have with me a couple of testifiers, and I'll get to them in just a moment. But I just want to give you a brief history or background on House File 3400. And it is about increasing state funding for long-term care reimbursement rates by 5% in the next fiscal year. The new resources must be directed to caregivers so that facilities can improve the quality of care they provide to Minnesota's sick, elderly, and disabled adults. For the past 5 years, long-term care workers have struggled to maintain an adequate level of care for residents and clients
despite flat or minimal funding increases. 0% in 04, 0% in 05, 2.26% in 06, and 2.25% in 07. As the industry faces this financial crisis, it has begun to cut into the most important element of quality care, frontline caregivers. Low pay, unaffordable health insurance, and high rates of workplace injury all lead to high rates of employee burnout and turnover throughout the industry. Not only do workers in nursing homes suffer the impact of inadequate funding, but so do the residents and consumers who are the elderly, disabled, and sick members of our society. Inadequate funding means fewer staff, longer working hours for less pay. Now, I have two testifiers with me today, and then we'll go over the bill. To my right, I have Mike Dreyer. Mr. Dreyer?
Go ahead, Mr. Dreyer. State your name for the record. You may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Mike Dreyer, and I'm with United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 789, and we represent approximately 3,000 nursing home workers. Let's talk a little bit about myself. I worked in the nursing home industry myself for 30 years. I started as an orderly. I became a certified nursing assistant, and then I worked in the building maintenance department. Today, I have a new hat. I now represent these workers. Many of these workers are making difficult choices. Many are single parents. They're trying to provide health care, put food on their table, and a roof over their head. Some are working two and three jobs to provide for their families. I'm here today asking you to support this bill and give livable wages and benefits to our workers who care for our seniors, our parents, and grandparents who deserve the very best care provided. However, we talk about these same issues year after year and still have no way to get these caregivers ahead without your help. You ask how we pay for this. Do we cut aid from other deserving programs? Sometimes cheap is expensive. Failing to properly staff and reward our hands-on caregivers is costly to the system, and workers' comp injuries, resident injuries, and preventable hospitalizations. Not spending money isn't the same as saving money. Finally, I know that everyone on the legislative committee has shown concern for the plight of these hardworking caregivers. This is why I'm here today representing them and asking you for your help. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I have Iris Freeman from the Seniors and Workers Group. She would also like to give some testimony.
Sure. Ms. Freeman, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Iris Freeman. I'm here on behalf of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition. As we visited with so many of you, we have pointed out the many members, AARP and the Alzheimer's Association, the Elder Care Rights Alliance, the Nurses Association, the Association of Social Workers, and the Union Coalition of Long-Term Care Workers, which includes the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, the Service Employees International Union, the Steelworkers, AFSCME, all of those people who care for our loved ones. The summary, if we would summarize, what is this coalition about? It's about four words: quality care, quality jobs. They really go together. And so House File 3400 summarizes many facets of policy for quality care and quality jobs. Nobody recognizes better than we and has struggled over the gulf between the February budget forecast and this proposal. I promise you, this proposal was not drafted on the moon. It was drafted, and we present it tonight because if we don't say this aloud, if we don't advocate for quality care and wages and employees' affordable health insurance, citing bad timing, we could sit quietly, silently for a long, long time. And so in the next 2 months, we're all going to be struggling and engaging in the art of the possible, in the world of the possible. But for this evening, Representative Fritz has asked me to describe the bill and the needs as our member organizations experienced these needs daily. There are four topic areas in the bill: the cost of living adjustment, the topic of rebasing, the topic of health care, affordable health care for long-term care workers, and staffing. House File 3400 would provide nursing facilities, ICFMR, intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, home and community-based services as well, with a 5.0% increase to their payment rate for the rate year beginning in October. Nursing homes would see an across-the-board increase equal to the amount set aside for rebasing, plus additional dollars to bring them up to the 5% standard. Other services would increase from the 2% that was enacted in 2007, with 3 additional percent to reach 5. On the topic of rebasing, I want to be very clear that Seniors and Workers for Quality are committed to rebasing. We are committed to departing this situation where we are paying for today's care with yesterday's rate. But the nursing home rebasing model adopted in 2007 doesn't seem to satisfy many of us. Doesn't work to bring rates up to date across the board with the necessary cost of care, and its 8-year timeline is too long. House File 3400, as drafted, required a task force that included legislators to develop a rebasing methodology. Any number of issues were raised about that. And so one of the amendments that was adopted to put the bill in the form you're discussing is one that removes the formality of a task force but keeps our eye on rebasing for the policy objectives that we come to share. For our part, we know that what we want to accomplish in rebasing is not only matching the costs of quality care and staffing with the rate that is available, but also allowing for the evaluation of the adequacy of these rates over time. And furthermore, for our part, we would like the legislature to consider rebasing in terms of the needs of home and community-based services as well. Because if we are to shift the focus of continuing care to home and community-based services, they can't be left in the dust. Healthcare for healthcare workers, House File 3400, takes several steps to help workers afford health insurance. Some of these are short-term fixes, all with an eye to reaching a much better system for all low-wage workers. We would provide a temporary rate increase to health facilities and services, buy private sector health insurance for their employees, and mechanisms to assure that the additional money is used for that purpose. It's modeled on the nursing home scholarship program. We would provide employees in long-term care facilities and services an exemption to the Minnesota care requirement that applicants not have access to employer-subsidized insurance, because what is often available is simply priced out of their reach. And like the Health Care Access Commission's recommendations and bills, we would ask the Department of Human Services to bring together the employee data and costs of a fully realized program to make private sector insurance affordable to these workers. We are indebted to Representative Fritz for co-chairing the subgroup of the commission on this topic. It is so important to us, and honestly, if these aims are reached through the Health Care Access Commission's bills, through this language, it doesn't matter. It is just the prize that we are seeking. The last issue is much smaller. It is a matter of reaching consistent terminology and staffing. There are libraries full of data linking nursing home staffing and staffing in other long-term care services to quality care. And there are today many references to staffing and the quality measures in Minnesota laws and rules and the quality measures in the report card and cost reports. House File 3400 would establish a working group, an informal working group of stakeholders and agencies to to make sure that the definitions of staffing are consistent. That will continue to help consumers who are searching for the right placement for a loved one and potential employers looking for jobs if they can compare staffing across establishments or situations. Today, many facilities are also taking new approaches to staffing, new job descriptions, so it's important to examine how we can support these creative approaches to staffing while still assuring that we can compare levels of personal attention given to residents and clients. I know the frustration, we all know the frustration you have to feel at hearing versions of this testimony year after year. I have sincerely believed all day that parts of this were written in 1979, delivered again in 1980, delivered during a budget crisis in 1982, and on. We are frustrated with continuing to have to deliver the testimony. We are desperately in need of a lasting solution to what is a growing societal need and a fiscal hot potato. The most important thing that we can say to you tonight from seniors and workers is that workers in home care, in community care, and in nursing facilities are worrying about whether they can afford groceries at the end of their shift. And I thank you very much.
All right. I see on the list there's a couple more. Justin Fritz, do we have some more testifiers? While the testifier coming up, Ms. Freeman did a very thorough presentation of the bill already. The hard part is not this committee, it's the next committee. And so I don't think we need... So I... With that, the testifier may go and begin, but just keep that in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I will take your admonition very seriously and be very brief. Members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We represent the many other providers that would benefit from this bill, ICFMR, and most of those in that long, long laundry list. I do want to thank you, Representative Fritz, and many of you folks for your long-time support of COLAs, of people with disabilities, and in particular in our world, direct support professionals. ARM members employ about 30,000 direct support professionals across the state of Minnesota with an annual payroll of about $361 million. We're at ARM fully aware of the challenge ahead of you and with the deficit. I'll talk more in Representative Huntley's division tomorrow about that. But you know, tonight I want to speak very briefly, not so much about providers, but about people with disabilities and the direct support professionals, people with, and the impact of the fiscal situation and the small COLAs over the years. People with disabilities, just one point, with such low pay for direct support professionals, we are witnessing a very, very high turnover among all of our members. High turnover means new people in group homes, day after day, week after week, and that has a real impact on the stability of services and ultimately on the very health and safety of people. It also drains a lot of money for training, hiring, marketing, to try to just keep those jobs filled. As far as direct support professionals, over the last 5 years, our rates have changed a little different from nursing homes, but that side is, it's been a net of 5.6%, an increase compared to 15% inflation. What this means is as Iris was saying, it's about groceries, it's about filling your car at the gas pump, it's about the basic human needs that folks are finding it increasingly difficult to pay for.
quick comment on the health insurance provision, and I want to thank you, Representative Fritz, for your work on the Health Care Access Commission. One of the great ironies in our world is only 39% of the direct support professionals who work with our members are offered health insurance, that they're able to afford that, and only 1 in 5, 20%, actually are covered with some semblance of health insurance. The great irony is here are very remarkable caregivers who don't have basic health care for themselves. So as you wrestle through, and I know it's just moving into the division, and wrestle with many difficult funding problems, I really urge you to, if you can, to consider the needs of people with disabilities and direct support professionals as we move ahead, and hopefully at the end of the day we can find something in our wallets for those folks. With that, I'll stand for questions. And
are there any questions, members? Representative Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, you said that with a smile.
I did.
Representative Fritz, thank you also for taking a shot at this. The obvious question is one that will come with the next committee, and that's how do we pay for these kinds of things? It's great to dream and to vision and to hope, and I know we live in hope. I think somebody said we'd be talking about the possible, and the possible cuts are going to be kind of the issue du jour. I am wondering, though, why not allow facilities to decide what to do with this extra money? I think it's great we're going to be trying to rebase, and appreciate the work of your group, working group from the Healthcare Access Commission. We spent a long summer together. But why not allow facilities to decide what to do with this extra funding? And then the other issue I have is I don't know that per diems are the best way for us to be subsidizing health insurance. I think finding more concrete ways to lower it, or perhaps doing things, and this came up earlier, you know, things like tax credits and vouchers are other ways we should be doing these sorts of things. But to the question.
Representative Fritz, or anyone testify that could address that?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nelson?
Your point is very well taken, and from our point of view, the current encumbrance is way overdone. The net impact when you take a small 2% increase is to force a provider to chop up a little teeny bit of money into so many pieces that at the end of the day, when you're trying to do the best thing for direct support professionals, and maybe the best thing for them that they want is health insurance, which this bill in part addresses. And the way the current law is stated, you're really forced to make some other decisions. You're forced to honor the work of somebody who's been there for 15 years the same way you honor the work of somebody who's been there 2 weeks. So we would very much support more flexibility, more simplicity. In fact, the bulletin that came out from the department on how to implement what you're talking about was 80-some pages long. I know folks from in our world, we police very hard to make sure that the money goes where it's intended. 76% of our budget are for direct support professionals, and rest assured, our members understand that the very heart of services and quality care for people are your direct support people, and I can't think of a member of ARM who doesn't put as much money, at least 76%, into compensation for those folks. But they need the flexibility to be able to honor the work of people who are committed to this profession and committed to the people they support.
Representative Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Is the long-term care imperative behind this initiative? I would think it would be a positive, but I didn't notice them on the list.
Okay. They're coming.
Good. Thank you.
That's a nod from the audience.
Ms. Freeman, go
ahead. Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwell, I wasn't kidding when I said some of this testimony dated from 1979 or earlier. each year, the very best we can do is a very, very small increase when there is an increase at all. And if you go back to some of those COLA decisions of the late 70s and early 80s, I can assure you, and legislators who served before you will assure you, that each year that little bit of money is so precious and needs to go in so many directions, but it's very, very hard not to be able to do what Mr. Nelson suggested, which was to reserve 76% for the wages and payroll-related costs and benefits of direct care staff. Lawmakers all those years ago decided one of the ways not to get calls asking, so where's my raise, was to be more specific in law and dedicate 75% of the cost of living adjustment to wages, benefits, and payroll-related costs, a percentage that is guided by the actual costs in facilities and services. And so it has for those reasons become especially important to seniors and workers, especially when there is so little new money, to be sure that we are at least able to target, to make the difficult choices, but mostly to be sure that three-quarters of those funds are directed to the workers.
Good. Members, we have two more testifiers. Why don't we finish those testifiers and then jot down your questions and we'll take one at a time. We have Mr. Lipp and Ms. Thurl. You could choose which one of you want to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. With me tonight is John Lipp, Vice President of Advocacy for Care Providers of Minnesota. Together we represent the long-term care imperative, collaboration on legislative and public policy issues reflective of long-term care. I'm mindful of your caution as well, Mr. Chair, so we'll try to keep our comments brief as well.
Thank you.
And also mindful that this is a policy committee, but we do want to join the seniors and workers for a call for increased funding for older adult services. The COLA portion of the bill, we do want to go on record as saying that we do support the bill's call for a 5% rate increase for 2008 or fiscal year 2009. We too, the long-term care imperative, have called for rate increases. Our two bills, House Files 3536 and 3636, were referred directly to finance. And so many of you will participate in discussion on those, I hope, in subsequent days. The reasons for the cost of living adjustment and rate increases, I know many of you are aware of those, and I won't belabor the points for too long, but it bears a reminder and a couple of points. First, this is an economic development issue. Minnesota nursing and residential care facilities alone contribute more than $2.6 billion, that's billion with a B, annually to the state's economy and support nearly 120,000 jobs. And so when we talk about financial viability for these centers, we're really talking about jobs and the potential loss of those jobs in local communities. Many of the care centers and long-term care providers are our community's major employers. And so we do want to make that clear, even though we know that this is not a jobs committee. A funding increase will help support the jobs in local economies, as we're all concerned about jobs issues this year in terms of the economy. Minnesota also has one of the largest funding gaps between daily rates and daily costs of Medicaid funding in the United States. Minnesota is currently is the fourth worst among 38 states surveyed. And for 2007, the gap between the Medicaid reimbursement rate and the cost of care in nursing facilities is projected to be nearly $25 per day. Also, we do want to underscore, I think seniors and workers said it well, but underfunding affects caregivers. Most of our caregivers are not in the business for money, and yet they deserve to make a living wage as they care for our parents and grandparents in some of the most vulnerable times of their lives. Every time a nursing facility funding is cut or a long-term care provider funding is cut, the most significant impact falls on our caregivers. And, Mr. Chair, I won't read this letter tonight, but this is just one example of nursing home workers that we deal with, where this particular caregiver has been working as a caregiver for nearly 2.5 years. She started at $9.13 an hour and is now up to $9.36 an hour, so less than a 50-cent increase over those 2.5 years. And she details her family budget. I won't go into detail now, but the long and the short of it is she's working at a deficit. Much like the state is facing a deficit, her household income is making a deficit, and she concludes that she can't make a living working in the care center anymore, and that's a problem. Finally, and this is a policy issue, Minnesota is growing older. I know we all know that, but it bears reminder that the first boomers reached the age 65 in the year 2011. That's not that far away, and we're very concerned that there is not a plan on how we are going to adequately serve the growing needs of seniors. Minnesota will need a wide spectrum of quality, accessible service options for our seniors, and we must stabilize and strengthen our existing nursing facilities and other older adult service providers if we stand any hope to stand ready to meet this need. Simply put, we can't transform a system that has a crumbling foundation. And so that is one of the messages we want to leave with you today. Just very briefly on health insurance, again, we want to echo the thanks to Representative Britt for co-chairing the Healthcare Access Committee Working Group on Health Insurance. We share the goal of increasing access to health insurance coverage for long-term care workers. It's a very important issue to our members and to the caregivers that work for our members. However, our first priority is to obtain base funding that providers can use flexibly, and we would need to know what trade-offs would be necessary in order to fund this section. And again, we know that's a discussion for finance. We do strongly support access for health insurance, but again, we realize in these times that there may be a financial discussion. There are several questions that need to be answered before moving this proposal forward. Data about what and who has insurance now, how to reflect self-insurance agreements, and other such questions. We support the study as proposed by the Healthcare Access Commission Working Group, and that is reflected in Section 13 of the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Lips?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. For the record, again, my name is John Lips with Care Providers of Minnesota. I was going to comment on two aspects of the bill. Ms. Freeman's final point related to staffing criteria and definitions and terminology and consistency and inconsistency. I just want to say for the record, we would be happy to participate in that policy discussion as it moves forward. There were two elements of the bill as it was originally drawn, which we actually oppose or which we have concerns about. We are not here to ask the committee tonight not to pass this bill out of here. We know that the discussion will be ongoing in the Finance Committee. But as it was originally drawn, this bill proposed to freeze the implementation of rebasing of nursing facility rates until a task force could have a discussion about it. I understand from the banter at the committee table that an amendment was prepared to that section of the bill, to Section 11, but I don't know if that's correct. I have not seen it, and I don't necessarily need to for the moment. I can just make my point kind of generally.
We've had both amendments.
Okay. Okay. Well, so rather than try to absorb this on the fly, Mr. Chair, I'll simply say that the bill...
Mr. Lips, why don't we have the author of the or someone from the Ms. Freeman?
Ms. Freeman, may
can you explain what you guys did for Mr. Lips? Hi, Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Iris Freeman for Seniors and Workers. I am reading it fully for the first time myself. Let me not be on record as proposing amendments solely to satisfy John Lips. So let's see what we did for John.
It seems like an okay idea to me, Mr. Chair.
It is getting late. The original language had Seniors and Workers' ideal of how to create a better rebasing system. It was quite a bit more formal than this rebasing amendment. It involved a task force. additional funds and probably additional process. It stipulated all of the stakeholders in the task force, as well as every question to be researched in the course of the study. What this does instead, and I sincerely hope it does satisfy the concerns of the long-term care imperative, because our eyes are focused on some bigger issues, is to say that we all agree that revisions need to be made in the rebasing law that currently exists, and those should be done next session. Before that, we would like an opportunity to air some of the different approaches to rebasing, not only the methods, but what is it we want to get out of this new money and these new rates. And that is what this amendment does. It takes away the formal task force. It instead provides for continued study through the legislative process.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, thank you. And Ms. Freeman, thank you for the explanation. The as amended Section 11 is far better for us than as it was originally drawn. The proposal of a task force, as well as the articulation of defined principles that should guide rebasing into the future, were both problematical for our members. I'll just conclude then by saying that the bill continues to present a choice about whether rebasing should begin to be implemented in 2008 as it was prepared and discussed by the legislature and by agency staff and by the advocates in 2007, or whether its implementation should be frozen or held until further legislative discussion can occur in 2009. That's an issue and a discussion that we can hold for another day and in the context of the Finance Committee. But I just want to say, as the bill moves forward, that the bill presents that question and it needs to be debated. Thank you.
Representative Gottwell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I asked earlier about facilities having the flexibility. I'm a little uncomfortable with this idea of saying, as you mentioned, they get this money, it's not a lot, they have to divide it up in many ways, and sometimes workers, I think the argument was, kind of get left out of the picture. And I have a great deal of respect for that perspective. I mean, we are underpaying these workers, especially in rural areas, and I don't know who is going to take care of our older adults as they age in this state if we don't do something about that. But that having been said, tying the facility's hands on that amount of money when they get so little of an increase concerns me. And I'm just wondering from the testifier if that is a concern for the facilities you're representing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, it is. Our sentiments are very similar to those that Mr. Nelson expressed. Our position is that the managers of the facilities know best how to utilize the money they have. They recognize that their staff are the most important resource that they have. So our preference is for as little encumbrance as possible, including the first level of encumbrance, which dedicates a certain percentage, customarily, at least in recent years here, to wages and benefits. The second level of encumbrance, as Mr. Nelson mentioned, was something new. It was in 2007, to my knowledge, was the first time we've had that additional level of encumbrance. It was somewhat hastily drawn during the wee hours at the end of the session, and we are hopeful that there'll be an opportunity to do some work on that piece at a minimum.
I do have similar concern as well, Representative Gottwell, with putting restrictions. I think if we, in the ideal world, we have plenty of money, I don't think we should worry, but in this sense, the COLAs or the increase are so small, I think we have to think of that before we move forward. Representative Liebman,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess to Ms. Freeman, my attention had been drawn by line 5.21 to 5.23, and now I think I understand this now, given the discussion that's gone on, but I had been wanting to ask you, you know, what that was about. As I understand this, essentially you're putting a moratorium, I hate to use that word in this committee now, tonight, but we're putting a moratorium on the implementation, on the rebasing until, in other words, we have to then specifically authorize it to go forward.
before it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I believe that both of the amendments add some new color to this. In fact, our position, and if the words need to be amended to reflect that, is that those dollars that were set aside for rebasing in this coming year be used for a rate of increase across the board. So to that effect, you know, that is in effect a 1 year delay. But we surely do not want this to be read as an opposition to the cause of rebasing. There are now several opinion or policy directions that lawmakers can take. The governor has recommended that rebasing be repealed altogether. We oppose that. There are ways that it can be slowed, quickened, ways that the money can be used across the board or used in some different ways this year, and then go forward. We're looking for a bit of a do-over, as it's called, but surely do not want to stop the process.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any more questions for testifier? I guess not. Representative Fritz, do you have anything to add before we vote on this?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members and testifiers. And I also just want to add on the rebasing, and I do think that last year in the end of session, the rebasing language was done on the fly, and we did have some problems with it. We've been discussing it and talking about it with the nursing home working group and all of those folks all through the interim, and we're continuing to work on it, and we'll continue to work on it until we get it right. The money is there. It's on the table. We want to put it to some good use, and the good use that I see is towards the COLA. So we'll be working on this, I'm sure, very hard, trying to get it through finance and on to the floor and up for a vote. So thank you again.
All right.
For listening.
I see no more questions. The chair renews Representative Fritz's motion to send House File 3400 to the Committee of Finance as amended. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Bill adopted. Thank you. I guess we're done. We officially adjourned. Thank you, members.
Thank you.